as I step in for Dean Dunham. He will be back with you next week, but if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion. Put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at one on LBC, it's James Hansen again, but now it's time for Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Abby. A packed programme tonight. Are Chinese cars taking over our roads? And if so, is that a security risk? We will hear about a plan to reintroduce eagles to England after a successful project did just that in Scotland. Artemis 2, the mission to the moon, has concluded successfully. And Artemis 3 is in development. We'll hear where humans are going next. There's a US roundup from our Washington correspondent and the latest from the Iran peace talks. But first, we don't rule the waves anymore, but should we get used to our diminished armed forces or replenish them at whatever it takes? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. Sir Keir Starmer has congratulated Peter Magyar on his victory over Viktor Orban in Hungary's prime ministerial election. He described it as an historic moment, not only for Hungary, but for European democracy. The National Election Office says there was a record turnout for the poll of 77%. The LBC presenter and foreign affairs expert Matt Fry says Viktor Orban's actions within the EU made him increasingly unpopular abroad.
There's a 90 billion euro loan which is supposed to go out to the Ukrainians to keep their war economy running. Viktor Orban, actually, after a lot of arm twisting, finally agreed to release the money in December and then changed his mind in February. This is really bad news for Ukraine. It is incredibly good news for Moscow. And there are all sorts of leaked transcripts indicating that the Hungarian foreign minister has been briefing the Russian foreign minister Lavrov on the very detailed goings-on in Brussels.
President Trump has criticized Sir Keir Starmer's handling of the US war with Iran again. He's accusing him of acting like Neville Chamberlain, who tried to appease Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. At the same time, Donald Trump has claimed the US or the UK will send minesweepers to the Strait of Hormuz while also declaring the US will blockade it. The former deputy chief of US naval operations, Rear Admiral Joe Sestak, thinks the president has underestimated Tehran continually.
The president, the commander-in-chief, didn't expect them to fight back. He was not ready for asymmetric warfare. They were shooting 600 drones at one salvo. We were using so many Patriots that in one day, 4 years of production of those Patriots was used up.
Downing Street says Sir Keir Starmer spoke with President Macron of France about the Strait of Hormuz during the day. The Prime Minister is facing calls to explain to Parliament why a deal to hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius has been shelved. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says he should go before MPs tomorrow to make clear that the deal is dead. A man's died after the car he was driving collided with three other vehicles while being followed by police in East Sussex. Emergency workers were called to the A21 at Roberts Bridge last night. An investigation is underway. And in sport and in tennis, Jannik Sinner has reclaimed the men's world number one ranking after beating Carlos Alcaraz in the final of the Monte Carlo Masters. The 24-year-old Italian won the match 7-6, 6-3. LBC weather, sporadic and isolated showers across much of the UK overnight. They'll be more concentrated over northwestern and northern Scotland. We'll see a low in some areas of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. HMS Dragon was originally set to be the flagship of a NATO operation earlier this week. But the Eastern Mediterranean deployment of that ship led to a change of plans. A grand ceremony at Portsmouth marked the Royal Navy assuming command of the operation, but not by using one of its own ships. Rather, Germany's FGS Sachsen. And reports this weekend suggest that the Royal Navy will be forced to ask the French for help intercepting Russian vessels in British waters because the UK fleet is struggling to meet what they call operational commitments. So, as the Chancellery does not seem to have the money for a navy or even an armed forces to match our sense of British exceptionalism, should we give up on that idea? Robert Fox is a defence commentator for the I newspaper and for The Independent, and he joins us on the line to talk about this now. Hello, Robert.
Hello, good evening.
Do you think that our idea of ourselves as Britannia ruling the waves is somewhat outdated?
It's very interesting. In the Battle of Crete, an outstanding admiral, Andrew Cunningham, said you can build the reputation of a service in 300 years and lose it in an afternoon. Well, the Royal Navy, over the last few weeks, has been losing its reputation in a few afternoons. The whole story of Dragon and Duncan, the two Type 45 destroyers, which cost $1 billion each, by the way, which were sort of available, now they're not available, is terrible. Also, that we have no ships to offer for the Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz. And as Bill Clinton used to love to say, denial ain't just a river in Egypt. The government seems to be in total denial about this. We've been, by the way, just to add very quickly, at the London Defence Conference. It's a private enterprise thing, but very well done. And you've had head of navies from around the world, but particularly from our closest allies like the Dutch, the Danes. And I think they are just frankly simply appalled at the performance. And what I have to say, but he must be called for it because it's the third time in a row, our Defence Secretary, John Healey, put up an absolutely appalling performance.
Is it so surprising, though, at a moment's notice, not to be able to provide the kind of boats that were required? Because I do note that America had problems with their large boats as well.
Yeah, they've had, on their biggest aircraft carrier, they've had a fire in the laundry and the loo's blocked up, and it's thought that that was the symptom rather than a cause of a very disaffected crew. No, it's not all perfect, but these ships potentially are very good, the Type 45 destroyers, the six of them, but only about two halves of them work at the moment, and that's the story of the task force, the NATO task force, which we say that the Navy has launched, but with a German flagship. The only two available were Duncan and Dragon, and we know what happened to Dragon. Dragon is in port somewhere, unspecified in the eastern Mediterranean. No prizes for guessing. It's probably Suda Bay in Crete, because it couldn't make fresh water or sufficient fresh water. It's this kind of thing that actually, it's laughable. And what we had last week was Defence Secretary John Healey saying how marvellous it was we'd tracked these very, very seriously threatening submarines, one major submarine and two mini submarines, looking rather nefariously at underwater communications in the North Sea. We had one frigate that could do that, which also has to double duty in protecting our main nuclear attack submarine, just about the only one going at the moment. And it all had to be assisted by the Norwegians. It's just that it sounds sort of yesteryear if we're saying we're not pulling our weight, but this is serious because we hear a lot about the NATO treaty. We hear all about Article 5, quite rightly, all for one for all. If one is seriously attacked, everybody comes to their help. As important now are Article 3 and Article 4, which a member must be capable of managing its own national defence. And it must be capable under Article 4 of contributing that defence to the assistance of others when others require. Britain is now deemed officially at failing in those two. In other words, our major NATO allies, in fact, I think all NATO allies, think Britain isn't capable of defending itself.
Now, of course, because Keir Starmer is in office, the Labour Party are in government, they are getting the blame for this. But really, what effect did the 10 years of defence budget cuts and decline under the Tories have and still have?
Oh, there's been continuous hollowing out, Nick. But from the defence review of 2010 seems to now have been, of the Cameron coalition government, to have been thoroughly dangerous. in the, what it cut, and there's a lot that's been made up. But the hollowing out and cutting actually started before that. It goes across party. And in what you have as a sort of a progressive-seeming party, like the Keir Starmer Labour government, it's amazing, I find, looking back on this, how averse it is to reform, serious reform. And I don't just mean in defence, in welfare and social affairs, in justice, in the constitution. They talk a great talk, but don't walk a walk at all. But now it's getting dangerous because the circumstances are so threatening to our well-being. The offer that Starmer is making to the French to help out with the Straits of Hormuz, yes, we do have a very direct interest there. We not only are obliged to allies, but actually what goes through the Straits of Hormuz directly affects us. We know that it's absolutely, it's puny. We had a frigate there before and a minesweeper. We've only got one minesweeper, and that's in repair. And he's offering God knows what to the French. If we have to clear the Straits of Hormuz, we've got these remote drones, autonomous robotic systems. I'll tell you, the way the Iranians are configured, the way the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is configured, you ain't going to do it just by robots. And this is where we're just simply kidding ourselves. Those straits are going to be closed for a very long time. And by the way, we're all going to feel it, and we're going to feel it very hard.
I note that much of the spending on defence equipment went on a nuclear deterrent. Why do we need to spend so much on a weapon that we're only going to use at the end of the world, and which major economies like Germany and Japan seem to be able to do without?
Well, for people, for practitioners and for people like myself who have to observe this day to day, I find it very difficult because you get from practical reporting facts in journalism to pure theology here. It's, you know, that if they do this, they will be deterred, and we have a particular obligation because we were one of the original nuclear powers. Let's cut to the chase. Okay, yes, it may be desirable at the upper end, but why are we spending $2 billion a year just on the warhead and launch system of the nuclear deterrent system, which isn't independent anyway, and dependent on America? You're absolutely right. But what they're not doing, they're simply not addressing priorities. We had a very glossy thing. It was like a Club Mediterranean away holiday for singles, a glossy pamphlet called the Defence Review last year. 62 recommendations. And himself, the Prime Minister, said, yes, this is central to our stuff. We agree to every single thing, but it depends on paying for it, called the Defence Investment Programme, or Plan, DIP, which was said at the latest, it would be available last September, because the paper came out, the glossy mag, in June to satisfy our allies. The plan is not going to be signed off, we understand now, possibly until next December, if we're lucky. But now the voices from the Treasury and so on are saying, given our other needs and requirements, it's probably not needed anyway. The very interesting thing is to watch the Prime Minister. He goes around, he makes all these pledges, and he leads from behind and then comes back. And that, this happened with a very strong pledge, he said, to up spending on defence at the Munich Security Conference in February. He came back, said, yes, we've really got to do it. We've got to spend more. We've got to get reform going. Oh, but they didn't allow me to do it. And it was the Cabinet, but principally the Home Secretary, the Foreign Secretary, and, of course, the Chancellor, who said, no more money in defence. And by the way, our backbenchers and voters won't support it because they say opinion polls say they don't prioritise defence. Well, opinion polls are now saying that the country is worried about its security, but they don't want to trade off welfare against it. But the point about the polls and the focus groups, they are never explained by the government of the very, very serious state of economic, social, and actually physical threat that we're under now.
Well, the government has thrown around some figures, possible, potential targets, 2.5% of GDP by April next year, which would be a rise of about £13 billion.
They spent most of it anyway, or forward pledged it, yeah, but, and not on the things you'd expect.
Right. But is there an automatic link between an increased budget and increased capabilities?
No. Because a lot of these things, to be blunt, a lot of these things need to be done quickly. The quickly thing is we're just very short of ammunition and munitions. We were hearing, and the Americans are even in a similar situation because of their high end weaponry like Patriot missiles. They've used up an awful lot of their stock. We gave quite rightly a lot of stock away to Ukraine after the invasion, Feb 22 there, but we've not replaced it. And the Treasury, particularly against it, it's not just the Treasury's fault. There's something wholly wrong with the machinery of government in this, because what is running out is that the operator's voice is being heard less and less and less. At the top end of the defence ministry now, including some of those in uniform, have very, very little operational experience. And that's why, and it's quite right that you have to bear in the governance of this country. But France is in a similar situation, Italy likewise, Germany less so. America even more. We're all saddled by terrific debt. We've got to spend money and find way of financing intelligently, smartly, in the defence that is really needed, and fund it. But that's where reform is required. It's no use sitting on our hands and saying, oh, the voters won't wear it. But by the way, I think that this debate really will break out into the open after May the 8th, after the local election. Well, we'll see where the support for the parties is. But what is happening is that Parliament is failing to look into this and make us aware of this very parlous situation that we're in. I was hearing just over the weekend, for instance, from the Baltic countries, they have 2.6... the three Baltic countries, over more than 2.6 million cyber attacks from Russia and its allies per day at the moment. It's coming here. We've had it already.
Another figure that they put forward was hitting 3.5% of GDP within 10 years, and that would be up...
Oh, forget, you know, that's Christmas in the next millennium.
Right,
you know.
But let's play a game and assume that that will be met, and that would be £36 billion. Do you think that because of the difficulties with procurement and the lack of experience at the top that you've just outlined, that we would find it hard to spend that much money well?
I think it could be done, but you'd have to do it with different agencies. At different times, you've had very extraordinary people, and they've usually been a bunch of misfits and eccentrics working as individuals who have looked at things. And there was one particularly outstanding one on the state of the army after the Boer War, and this is not a joke. The British Army nearly lost the Boer War. Some people realised this, and they got an eccentric courtier called Lord Esher to write a report in saying how the army must reorganise itself if it has to fight a foe of equal sophistication and equal weight. In other words, it was looking forward possibly to the Great World War as it happened. Esher said several things. Don't have big committees, have a single mind, write it through, make it quite simple, and don't go on forever. What did the Strategic Defence Review, the Club Med brochure, do? It was millions of words. So many millions of words organised by this government, they had to get AI. And AI, it was the best of times, the worst of times, did its best and did its very, very worst in coming up with an absolute load of splurge and spaghetti and all these wonderful things, which we knew at the end of the day we couldn't afford. And you're quite right. We've got to look at the thing from top to bottom. What do we really need now? What can we get? What must we get quickly? Ditch the luxuries. Really look at things like the nuclear weapon that we've got now, and things like aircraft carriers, which will never work up to full expectation. also, right across the piece, how you involve people in this thing. People in their own defence. And it doesn't mean about fighting. It means being resilient against things like cyber attacks, against natural disasters, and so on. The Dutch have done it. They've turned it around. They've got a proper paid volunteer reserve that you can join as you leave school. You can go in for a year or so, and you get a bit of a salary, a bit of a qualification. You don't have to do combat things necessarily. You can do disaster relief and so on. And it could be a career, but it could be just an experience which may be valuable for society in the future. It's that kind of approach. The British government, the British politicians have been confronted with this, and they say, no, 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 you're putting child soldiers into uniform.
Mm. Just finally, everything that we've talked about...
I hope you don't think I'm ranting.
Not at all. No, I am rapt. Would it not make sense, given everything that we've just said, to pool our resources with our European friends, eliminate waste and duplication that would come with a European Defence Force?
Well, whether you call it the European Defence Force, I'd do it and not tell anybody you're doing it, except your friends, and say we're doing it, and don't give it a fancy name, because you'd probably have to go to Madison Avenue and get a logo invented by Peter Hegseth, and we'd have to have Crusader tattoos. It's that kind of trivialisation, that gamification of war, which is rotten and rubbish. By the way, I see a lot of our allies are very much tied up with the Dutch, you know, being in an Anglo-Dutch family. I've spent a lot of time in my working life in Italy. I was at the Anglo-Italian Journalist Conference. The goodwill to this country is shaming. It's so strong. Come on, we want you. We want you to help. Help us get together. Let's pool our resources. We're in real trouble. We're all aging societies. We've got all kinds of problems there. Let's do it. But, you know, why we all have to have an individual tank, and we go on, oh, we have to have a British tank because we invented the tank, so we come up with an 80-ton monster that no bridge in Europe can take. This kind of thing. It's complete... It's wonderful. I mean, who needs Armando Iannucci? Who needs... Who needs the fun factory? It's such a huge black laugh anyway.
Robert, very good to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time. That's Robert Fox, the defence commentator for the I newspaper and for The Independent. So what do you make of that? It has been, I suppose, embarrassing, would be putting it mildly, some of the revelations about the ability of our defence forces to muster themselves. Should we give up on the idea of pretending that we are still Britannia ruling the waves, so that we can make it on our own and actually chip in with our fellow Europeans and provide something that could be a real force to protect us all? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
This is a shameful, this is a shambles, straight to the point.
How was that allowed to happen?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Show some evidence, Minister.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Next.
Hi, just these, thanks. Do you do cashback?
Just need to check you're not a robot first. New security policy.
Okay.
How many traffic lights can you see out the window?
Oh, two?
No, that's wrong.
Right, well, obviously I'm not a robot.
That's what a robot would say.
What a load of malarkey. Smarty keeps things simple, like 80 gigabytes for £10. And on a rolling monthly SIM plan, you're free to leave any time. Less malarkey, more Smarty. Search Smarty Mobile.
When you're smiling...
Don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling and the whole smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, we're talking about the state of our defence forces, which have been shown to be somewhat crumbling of late, but I wonder if that is certainly partly due to the 10 years of cuts under the Conservative government. At the end of their tenure, they did start to spend a little bit more, but of course the damage has already been done. You can't really blame the Labour Party for everything that ails this country. It takes a lot longer to build something back up than it does to smash it to bits. But they're in charge now, and they have some, and as the phrase is, big decisions to make, and is one of them to actually stop thinking that we can take care of ourselves, because we're not this mighty empire anymore. We are a small, medium-sized economy, relatively unimportant, on our own, bobbing away on the sea off the coast of Europe. We don't bestride the world anymore. The map's not pink. Do we just have a problem getting our heads around that? And do you think that the money that we do spend on the military is being spent well? Because we do hear tales of the dismal accommodation that our fighting force has to put up with. And if you come from a position of not being able to sleep, or there's mould on the wall and the drafts coming through the windows and all that sort of stuff, then it doesn't really put you in the best frame of mind to protect the nation. Are we actually are politicians actually addicted to buying big stuff that looks great in the background of a photo opportunity? Goring by Sea. Hello, Ash.
Hi, Nick. Hope you're well.
Yes, thanks.
Good. I think that we need to make a point of increasing taxes. I mean, it's something I'd be quite happy to do if it meant they could invest more in the defence forces, because I just don't know where they're going to find the money at the moment.
Well, that's not that wouldn't be a popular idea, and it's probably not one that any government wants to propose. More taxes to spend on things that go boom and bang.
I know, but I think that, you know, if we were to pay more taxes, like more taxes, it could protect us and our whatever our economic situation could be in the future. You look at Keir Starmer being stuck between a rock and hard place trying to appease Trump, and Trump threatening to leave NATO. I just don't know what the solution could be other than increasing taxes, even if it's a little bit. I know that they have pledged to raise, I think it was 2.5% of GDP mm-hmm. by this time next year.
Yeah.
And I think I read some of it, they've even cut foreign aid to potentially used for the defence forces. I just don't know what else they could do. I would, I know you said it's an unpopular choice, but I think I'd sleep a bit better at night knowing that more money has been invested in the defence forces, because it's difficult, but
It's very difficult to do the maths, but it seems logical to me that if we did pool our resources with our European neighbours, to whom we used to be close friends, it would give us the immediate uplift in our defence capabilities, because we specialise in certain things, and so do they. So, you know, between the group, we would be able to immediately increase our defensive capability. But it would also seem likely that by removing duplication and making the whole thing more efficient, that we could buy more with less money.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not a subject I really knew much about until I started listening in, so I definitely will research on it a bit more. But I suppose one silver lining to this Iran situation is how it's exposed to the public, I suppose, how almost defenceless we are, and the need for some reform in the defence forces.
Yeah. Well, we all become experts on whatever subject happens to be in the news at the time. Now we all know about the Strait of Hormuz. But what about the idea of the nuclear deterrent? It always has struck me as being a bit pointless, really. I mean, at what juncture would we actually send a nuclear weapon into the sky in order to obliterate millions of people in some foreign part? I mean, that would be the end of the world. So what's the point of having it, really? If Germany and Japan and most other countries in the world can get along without having it, then why do we feel that it's necessary for us to have it?
Exactly. And I'm not sure if it ties on to the same sort of thing, but for years people have been saying, you know, about Russia and North Korea with the nukes and how they could use them on an enemy territory. But if they did, they've got all these other countries across the world that also have nukes, so they're not going to do something like that, I would hope. So, yeah, I do see your point there.
All right, thanks a lot, Ash. Appreciate that. 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850, email nicka@lbc.co.uk, and if you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973. More of your thoughts on the state of the British military to come. We're going to take a news break, after which, on the same topic, the failed Middle East peace talks have led to a response from Donald Trump to Iran not letting ships sail safely out of the Strait of Hormuz. A blockade on ships entering the Strait of Hormuz. Is he playing 5D chess, or does he just have no idea what he's doing? Is he essentially winging it? 0345 6060 973. 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Sir Keir Starmer has congratulated Peter Magyar on his victory over Viktor Orban in Hungary's prime ministerial election. He's described it as an historic moment, not only for Hungary, but for European democracy. President Trump has again criticised Sir Keir Starmer's handling of the US war with Iran. He's accused him of acting like Neville Chamberlain, who tried to appease Adolf Hitler during the 1930s. And the prime minister is facing calls to explain to Parliament why a deal to hand over the Chagos Islands to Mauritius has been shelved. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says he should go before MPs tomorrow to make clear the deal is dead. LBC weather, sporadic and isolated showers will break out across the UK overnight, although they will be more concentrated in northern and northwestern Scotland. We'll see a low in some parts of the UK of around 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades, and why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no. Just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
Next.
Hi, just these, thanks. Did you cash back?
Just need to check you're not a robot first. New security policy.
Okay.
How many traffic lights can you see out the window?
Two.
No, that's wrong.
Right, well, obviously I'm not a robot.
That's what a robot would say.
What a load of malarkey. Smarty keeps things simple, like 80 gigabytes for £10. And on a rolling monthly SIM plan, you're free to leave any time. Less malarkey, more Smarty. Search Smarty Mobile.
Calling all young creatives. Kickstart your career in media. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12 at Global Academy. GlobalAcademy.com.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So, President Trump has said that the United States of America will enforce a naval blockade on the Strait of Hormuz after the peace talks between top Iranian and American leaders in Pakistan ended without a major breakthrough. Let's talk about this with Malcolm Nance. Malcolm is the former U.S. Navy intelligence officer and best-selling author, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Malcolm.
Good evening.
Do you think it's surprising that they didn't agree straight away?
Well, no, that's not surprising at all, particularly when you consider that the two sides have diametrically opposed maximalist demands. I mean, Iran wants reparations for every, all the damage that was done in control of the Strait of Hormuz, and the United States wants denuclearization and a whole slew of other things that both sides are just not going to be able to work down to, certainly not in a two-day summit like that. So, but where it goes from here can only be escalation.
Yeah, well, Trump keeps saying that he's won. Is that because he surrounds himself with people that can't find the nerve to tell him otherwise?
Yeah, well, that's pretty much it. Look, you know, I play it straight as an intelligence officer. Someone comes to me, let me tell you something. I was senior enlisted, right? Which means I'm the guy that actually collects most of this information, has to synthesize it, pass it on to intelligence staff officers, and then they pass it up and it gets signed off, right? So we know at the street level just exactly what's going on. So if we pass something up to them that the Iranians have mined the Strait of Hormuz, we have imagery intelligence of it on one day, and we would have to assume that that was one day and that for 44 days they were doing the same thing, then you just have to go with it. But if you're going to die, if you're standard is that you have won a war simply because you have dropped thousands upon thousands of bombs and struck thousands and thousands of targets, but you get no political change, no change in the national will, no change in their operational capacity to hurt the global economy and their regional allies, then you haven't won and you can't declare victory. That's the way a five-year-old thinks. And I'm afraid that the president surrounds himself with a bunch of sycophants who think that dropping fancy bombs and wasting all of our cruise missiles is victory. It's not. If that was the case, we won Vietnam. We won Afghanistan. Obviously not. We lost both.
Yes, Trump does seem to be still trying to act the tough guy, like the class bully in a toddler's playgroup. Do you get the sense that there is any strategy to this, or is he just winging it?
You know, I think initially when this was tasked over to General Kane, who is surprisingly, I mean, this guy was started out his career. People believed that he was going to be a real political sycophant. But he appears to be the adult in the room. The only problem is he views the imperial power of this presidency as absolute. That even though as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he is supposed to be giving advice to the president of the United States, no matter, you know, an unfurnished advice. So, I mean, you know, you can't gild something that's really bad. Worse, they apparently never, ever mentioned the consequences of this action. We have been preparing for this war since 1979. I fought in the Persian Gulf against the Iranians in the mid late 1980s. We knew everything that was going on there. We knew their capacity to close the Strait of Hormuz. That was back before they had thousands of anti-ship missiles, thousands of mines, thousands of guys who would come out in small boats and suicide bomb you, and drones, tens of thousands of drones. That was back, you know, when they weren't as lethal. Now we know they're lethal. Therefore, there will always be consequences. The chairman didn't apparently give him any of that advice, and Trump didn't hear it or care about it. And with Pete Hegseth at command, which is laughable because he was a major in the National Guard. That's like your territorial reserve. He should never have been near this job to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. They're all about bombs, guns, and fighter jet rides, right? Dudes with guns. That's a joke in the armed forces. We are very serious. We understand strategy, and we understand that tactical success or operational success does not mean that you have met political goals. Literally, the basics of von Clausewitz, right? War is politics by other means. Trump and Hegseth seem to think by waging a war, you automatically win at politics. No, doesn't work like that.
Yeah, so Trump seems to be mistaken in saying that he's won, but Iran believes that it has won. Do they have more of a point? Because they've withstood the blows from the biggest military on earth. They retained their regime in power. They have the world's economy in their hands, and they've still got their nuclear program.
Okay, let's add a few more points to that, right? They are now, by dint of decree by Donald John Trump, they are now raking in sanction-free oil. Any oil that makes it to a tanker is not sanctioned. Free money, $14 billion at last count. There's talk about us allowing them to access their money in the banks of Qatar and the United Arab Emirates for another $6 billion. That by charging $2 million per vessel in the Strait of Hormuz, on average 140 vessels enter and leave every day through the SOH. They will, in a year, make $160 billion. That's more profit than the actual oil in the Strait of Hormuz. The toll booth is far more profitable. This is madness. I mean, Trump has, I'm going to be straight up with you, okay? This war, the United States has lost this war, period. It has met no goals whatsoever. And Iran is making bank.
How will America blockading the Strait of Hormuz help?
Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. I hope you didn't hear that little aside. You know, I've been involved in operations against Iran where we've blockaded their ports, you know, and, you know, had them sanctioned. Same thing with Iraq. You know, we're you know, I've served 10 years in that region. That doing this particular operation, I've served 40 years in the Middle East, North Africa. Look, this is like saying you're going to set up, there's a toll booth on the M5, right? And that after there's a toll booth, I will set up my own toll booth and won't let anyone that just passed that toll booth come into the roundabout. I mean, this is ludicrous. You cannot blockade these ships. They are mainly, first off, they're international. They're mainly going to China. China could send its own frigates to guard and escort its vessels out of Iranian territorial waters. The second country that is the largest exporter right now is India. Indian economy will collapse. Global medicines will collapse, by the way, because that's where most of our generic medicines in the world are made. They're made in India with chemicals from the Gulf states. The third largest exporter of oil right now that Iran is allowing in and out is Pakistan. Who's negotiating this? This is why they're so desperate to negotiate. They get 20% of all the fuels and oils that they need out of the Gulf. So what are you going to do when these ships come out of the Iranian traffic separation scheme, the new what we call multi-pass traffic separation scheme? What are you going to do? Tell them to stop? The key question is, what happens when they don't stop? You have two options. Three, visit board search and seizure, where we put a landing team on there. They could lock themselves in the bridge and keep going, and there's nothing you're going to be able to do about that. Or you're going to fire on those vessels and sink them or damage them, or you're going to take down their name and let them go. And option number three is what's going to happen.
Well, let's assume just for just to save face, Donald Trump gets more belligerent. Are there more than two options? One, invading Iran, which would probably be a disaster to eclipse Vietnam, or restart the bombing. Now, can you restart the bombing and produce a different result?
Well, I mean, you restart the bombing, there's only one result that really matters here. And everybody should take this very, very seriously. It will collapse the global economy. I mean, we are weeks away from it. Don't believe me? Go out and find all those oil traders and experts on the internet, like Mr. Global, right? On Twitter, on X. These guys really know about the flow of oil. And they're saying that if this continues, this cutoff, helium going to Asia will cripple a year's microchip development because they need that. Liquid natural gas going to Japan. China has stopped exporting every drop of fertilizer. So that means when you go to your garden store in England, you will find out that most of your product actually comes from China. They're not exporting that anymore. So this year's gardening is going out the window. But worse, half of of Asia and Africa are going to starve because urea nitrate is not coming out through the main Gulf exporters. And if Trump blockades Iranian urea nitrate or Iranian natural gas or Iranian oil, it's literally like setting yourself on fire and saying, look, I made a bigger light than that candle over there. This is ludicrous. It's really, I'm sorry to say it, mental illness disguised as foreign policy. That's what's going on here.
Do you think that America has to be the one that has to back down? Unfortunately, they have a leader at the moment who seems incapable of doing that. Iran seems to have been better prepared for this war. The Americans don't seem to have prepared for anything other than an immediate victory. And the world's economies are going to collapse, like you just alluded to. Yeah. And that will hurt America and its allies a lot more than it will hurt Iran, which is already poor.
Yeah, well, you know, Iran's not poor. Okay. Iran, of course, is a country that's a developing world, but it feeds itself. None of the border states around it, other than Kuwait, have cut off trade to Iran. Food comes in from Azerbaijan. You know, products come in and go out to Turkey, right? So long as they have dates, pomegranates, kebabs, and tea, they can sit there and wait us out. It's literally, I mean, the Persian culture is 5,000 years old for a reason, right? They have the ability to one, defend themselves in a nation that's 80% mountains, right? And two, they have the ability to go back and forth to produce materials and to live a very simplistic Islamic life and not have that crush their souls. They fear Allah. They trust in that. That right there is their motivating factor. And we cannot break that with bombs, right? Ask the democratic government of Vietnam. They're communists. They won. So long as they have the willpower and the ability to resist, and I'm looking at cities like Dresden, Germany, right, which we bombed with 1,000 bomber raids day and night, they won't surrender. There's no victory here for Trump. The only victory he can have is to take an off-ramp and call it a victory.
Yeah, that's going to be very difficult for him, though. I mean, Trump keeps threatening obliteration and annihilation and so on, but then does not deliver on his threats, which must make a man with a mind like his furious. Do you think that at some point he's going to have to save face and follow through with one of his childish threats unless there's somebody there to stop him? Is there somebody there to stop him?
No, there's nobody there to stop him, and that's the problem. I mean, the only thing let me roll that back. There is one thing that will stop Donald Trump, and that's the fact that he will lose enormous quantities of money on the basis of the investments that he's made. Right now, I've predicted this every morning. I do a Substack, you know, intelligence assessment with a couple of other intelligence experts. And one of the things that we say every time is that Trump International Golf Course in Dubai is not getting built. Trump Tower Riyadh is not getting built. Trump Tower Qatar is not getting built. The $13 trillion that he allegedly claims they promised to invest in the United States, some of that may come, but it has nothing to do with Donald Trump. It has to do with them protecting the fact that they're going to have to live off interest income for the next 10 years because they have lost trillions of dollars of market capitalization and actual physical infrastructure because of decisions made by Donald Trump. That's the only thing that affects him, is what money he's going to lose, and he's losing it.
Malcolm, very good to talk to you. Thanks so much for that. Malcolm Nance, the former U.S. Navy intelligence officer and best-selling author. Now we're going to take a short break and then come back with more of your thoughts. If you have thoughts on what you just heard, then I'd be interested. But we were talking about the state of the British Defence Force and whether we should accept our diminished role in the world.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The day a dance class turned into a murder scene.
There has been a knife attack on a property in Hart Street. This is getting very serious indeed. I think we should be bracing ourselves.
The killings of three innocent girls at a Taylor Swift-themed class left a nation asking how such an atrocity could ever have been committed. Last year, justice was delivered.
I sentenced him to custody for life with a
minimum term which he must serve in custody of 52 years. It is highly likely that he will never be released.
Next week, the chance for further accountabilities as the Southport Inquiry publishes its Phase 1 report. The red flags, the missed opportunities, will it bring the answers the families and a country so desperately deserve?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less less. Irish Ferries, see you travel differently. T's and C's apply.
McGriddles, a new McDonald's breakfast. So it's maple syrup infused. It's sweet, then it's savoury. Because the sausage, you know, and the cheese and the egg. Oh, it's got the golden arches stamped on it too. Make that make sense. It's hard to put into words, but... Until 11am, subject to availability. Fees apply to delivery orders while stocks last.
Cancer doesn't care about childhood. It doesn't care what they miss out on or how much you want to protect them. But we do. At Great Ormond Street Hospital Charity, we fund life-saving research, vital family support, and the special things that help seriously ill kids be kids. Until no childhood is lost to cancer. Join us. Search GOSH Charity.
All right, resistance up. Let's climb.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, my knee's playing up again.
Have you ever had it looked at?
No, but I've been doing a few stretches.
When my shoulder went, Benenden Health got me expert help. Showed me exactly where I was going wrong.
30 seconds, people.
Press play on your health with physiotherapy and much more. All for less than £16 per person per month. Search Benenden Health. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services, including physio. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
So we've become rather aware of the lack of preparation, the lack of depth of our military. Just recently, it's become quite glaringly obvious that we are certainly not the force that we used to be. I don't think we're the force that we think that we are. Do we have to just get used to our diminished place in the world? And what about this idea of pooling our resources with European neighbours? Of course, that's going to upset the usual suspects. But perhaps they are, even though they are wearing Union Jack socks in a lot of cases, perhaps they are not being patriotic. Blackpool. Hello, Barry.
Hiya, Nick.
Barry.
Hey, how embarrassing, isn't it? What an embarrassment, this. Having to go cutting onto the Germans and the French after our history, what we've had in the past, you know.
Are we still fighting World War II, Barry?
Oh, well, there's nothing now. We're just having, I'm in my 70s now. I wouldn't remember any of the wars, but when you think back, well, I mean, even I remember the Falklands War, I mean, but when that took off, but Thatcher had battleships, but, you know, lots of them going, didn't she? We had John Healy on the Nick Ferrari show the other day, didn't even know how many battleships we've got.
Yes, I heard that clip, yeah.
Or frigates. I don't even think he knows what a frigate is. I don't think he knows what the difference is between a battleship and a frigate. So we've got 17 frigates.
All right, but that's the problem. So what's the solution? Do you want to pay more tax?
Oh, no. Cut the benefit.
Well,
I mean, we're paying out 320, from what I've looked on the internet, we're paying £323 billion out in benefits.
Yeah, half of that is the state pension. Would you be prepared to forego your state pension?
Is it as much as that?
Half.
I thought it was about 60 billion.
I don't know what the actual number in money is, but half of the benefits bill is the state pension.
So it's like $150 billion.
Again, not familiar with the actual amount in cash, no. But the percentage.
Perhaps I'd thought that that triple locker thing. I mean, I would get it. I've just worked out what I'll be getting on that. I'm getting about £10 a month, so it's neither here nor there, is it? I thought it that.
£10 a month, right? For the protection, for the protection of the country. Okay, Barry, thanks for that. Vancouver, hello, Nick.
Yeah, hi, Nick. I think the irony is that Britain is losing its power by its attempt to look powerful. I mean, you asked before, why do we have nuclear weapons? The answer is quite simple. So we can sit on the Security Council of the UN. That's the only reason. You know, why do we keep bases all over the world that cost a fortune in order to curry favor with the American? Like, why does Britain have Air Force bases in Cyprus? It's not defending Britain. Kent's not going to be invaded from Egypt, is it? You know, you keep bases in Cyprus and in the Indian Ocean at vast expense in order to look like you're an international power that you're not. And if the Americans want Diego Garcia, sell it to them. That'll save a little bit of the budget. Sell America Diego Garcia. Say, here you go. $5 billion, yours, forever.
I think one of the problems is that if a politician suggested anything that you just said, that we should, you know, draw in our tentacles a bit and try not to spread ourselves out quite so thinly, that they would be accused of, you know, running this country down, and are we not a great nation anymore, and people would be striking up Rule Britannia, and I know exactly what would happen. All of the people that are complaining about the lack of of our defence force now, it was suggested that we stop spending on one thing in order to boost what we might actually use, the complaints would be endless. So that's probably one of the reasons why no politician has suggested that, for fear of what the press will say.
Yeah, but it's that the irony is that because of that, the UK is becoming more and more defenseless and more decrepit. You have to let go of the nostalgia. You really do.
Decrepit.
You have to recognize your place in the world and cut your cloth accordingly, as my grandfather used to say.
Well, you're in
part
Canada.
Of the reason you can't
I
was going to say, part of the reason you can't improve is if you don't recognize your faults. You know, if one of my kids comes home with two D's and an E on his math homework, I don't go, well, your grandfather was really good at math, so don't worry about it. I kick his ass.
Well, I wonder if this is the kind of thing that countries all over the world are having a conversation about, because, you know, the government of the day will lead you to believe that you are safe, and you're only safe because of their good work. Are people in Canada having similar conversations about the state of your military there?
Yes, and there is a move to ramp up the Canadian military vastly, because obviously we now have an enemy at our doorstep in the United States of America, which I never thought I'd hear myself say, but it is true. You know, not that we can take on America, but fortunately the sheer size of Canada makes it a difficult country for even the U.S. to contemplate invading.
Well, America can't defeat Iran, then it's highly unlikely they'll be able to defeat Canada.
Yeah, and ironically, Russia can't defeat Ukraine, and that's Europe's greatest enemy. With a little bit of help from the EU and the UK, Ukraine could completely eliminate Russia as an enemy, and then this need wouldn't be quite so great.
Yeah. All right, good talking to you, Nick. Thanks for that. Yes, I wonder if we are actually hooked on spending on big things. As I said before, things that look good in the background of a politician's photo opportunity. Big boats and big tanks and stuff like that. I wonder if the cheap drone technology that is being used by Ukraine to such great effect against the much bigger power of Russia, I wonder what that has done to the people's thinking about defence spending. Because if you can keep a country as determined and well-resourced as Russia at bay with some homemade drones, then why do we need nuclear weapons? What's the point? And apart from anything else, when our ships were required, they did not work. I have been suspecting for a long time that if our nuclear weapons were required, would they work? Shetland. Hello, Kerry.
Good evening, Nick, from Windy Shetland.
Oh, yes.
Well, I wanted to congratulate Malcolm on his great assessment of the situation in the Strait of Hormuz and in that area of the world. Obviously, the guy's very well versed on that. But, you know, I will come back to that in a second. I would like to just make a few points on that.
Mm-hmm.
But regarding our Navy, yeah, we got 6 destroyers. What is it? 7 frigates. You know, these ships are great. They cost a lot of money, and then they go wrong, and they have to go into port to be repaired. it takes a long time to build a ship like that, and it costs millions of pounds. But that, just having said that, a submarine can blow that ship out of the water pretty quickly. So we're not too concerned. I'm not too concerned about how many surface ships we have. I'd be more concerned about how many submarines we've got, which is far more deadly than lots of frigates and lots of destroyers.
Yeah, more expensive, I would imagine. I mean, I don't really know how much these things cost, but I can't imagine that a boat that can go underwater would be less expensive than one that can't.
Well, actually, I believe it's less expensive to build a submarine than a great big frigate, which obviously requires a lot of personnel as well. But I just wanted to go back to the Strait of Hormuz, if I might, for a moment.
Yeah.
Donald Trump he wants to instigate a blockade. Well, a blockade, and you can check this out, is actually an act of war. But the question is against whom? Now, JFK, at the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I was quite young at the time. I think it was in 61, 62. Anyway, he didn't call it a blockade. He called it a quarantine because he knew the word blockade against Russia would be an act of war. So, but Trump has made a mistake because China has about 40% of China's oil comes through the Strait of Hormuz. And China's only got approximately 4 months of reserves of oil in their country. In fact, the Strait of Hormuz, more Chinese oil come from there than anywhere else. Now, can you imagine what happens if Trump instigates a blockade? And we shouldn't be there for that blockade. We might be useful in doing some minesweeping if we ever get HMS Dragunov into that area, which is doubtful.
Right.
But let's hope that he doesn't do a blockade because it could upset China. And of course, Trump hasn't got a clue. He's surrounded by amateurs. He's an amateur himself. He hasn't got.
Well, it seems evident that he seems to be just making it up as he goes along. Let's put it like that. Thank you, Kerry. Plenty more opportunities to talk about this on LBC to come. Going to take a news break, after which let's talk about, well, China, but not their weaponry or their oil, their cars, their electric cars. Chinese-owned automotive brands make up 1 in 7 new purchases of cars in the UK. The one from Jaesu is the nation's top seller in March this year. Should we be alarmed about that?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. Viktor Orban, the right-wing leader of Hungary, who became allied with Presidents Trump and Putin, has conceded defeat in the country's general election. He's been governing for the last 16 years, but has now lost to his centre-right opponent. Dr. Georgios Samaras is a lecturer in public policy. He's been telling LBC economics have played a major role in the defeat of Viktor Orban.
Prices have been rising in Hungary over the past 15 years much faster than any other EU country. The economy is in trouble. And when the economy is in trouble, people don't want to see such performative acts by the sitting government. They want to see actual manifesto pledges to turn things around. Viktor Orban has done none of this.
Sir Keir Starmer has stressed the need to protect the freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz during a phone call with President Macron of France. Downing Street says the two leaders have discussed the need to build a coalition of partners to get international shipping moving through the route. Donald Trump says British minesweepers will be sent to the shipping lane, but the defence commentator Robert Fox has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC the UK doesn't have the right hardware for the job.
We've got these remote drones, autonomous robotic systems. The way the Iranians are configured, you ain't going to do it just by robots. And this is where we're just simply kidding ourselves. Those straits are going to be closed for a very long time. And by the way, we're all going to feel it, and we're going to feel it very hard.
The Armed Forces Minister says the status of UK bases on Cyprus is non-negotiable. The island's president has called for talks over the sovereignty of Akrotiri and Decalia once the war in Iran is over. The Liberal Democrats are saying they will make a call in Parliament tomorrow for a cut in fuel duty after large price rises caused by the war in Iran. The party says it will table a motion demanding an immediate reduction of 10 pence on every litre. And a man's been arrested on the suspicion of murder following the discovery of a body in a garden near Bristol. Police were sent to Filton early on Thursday morning. He was in his 20s and had been stabbed. LBC weather, sporadic and isolated showers will break out across the UK overnight. They'll also be more concentrated in northern and northwestern Scotland. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Official car sales figures for March revealed that at the top of the charts, having overtaken the best-known names in motoring like Ford and Vauxhall and Volkswagen, is the JSU 7. It's a petrol hybrid-powered SUV from China, which looks a bit like a Range Rover, but costs half the price. Some are concerned that the proliferation of Chinese cars on our roads is something of a security problem. So let's talk about that and other related issues with Steve Berry. Steve is the motoring journalist and former Top Gear presenter, and he's on the line now. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Nick. It doesn't look a bit like a Range Rover. It looks a lot like a Range Rover.
Like some...
and that, of course, is deliberate.
Like somebody's taken tracing paper.
Yeah. Well, China's never been too bothered about intellectual property, has it? Or kind of infringing upon other people's trademarks. And this is at the root of all this. The kind of the unfairness of it all, where it's one rule for them in their market and it's another rule for us in our market, where we just seem to say, yeah, okay, in you come. Nick, I'm 62 next birthday. I've seen this twice before. I've seen it with Japanese cars as a kid when my dad finally gave up on the rubbish that he was being peddled by Chrysler and Ford and Vauxhall. And let's not forget, when we have this conversation, that Ford, Chrysler and Vauxhall were all American companies. Why do British people think that Ford is a British car? The Ford Motor Company of Detroit, Michigan, are American, have always been American, but for some reason they managed to con us on that it was a British car because it was made here.
The thing about the similarity, but let's deal with it like one by one. The similarity between this new, am I pronouncing it right? The JSU, this JSU 7 thing.
Well, pronunciation is a modern media thing, isn't it? In certain parts of the world, particularly the BBC, can't wait to wrap their tongues around difficult vowels and pronunciations. Right. But why don't we say München or Paris or Torino? We don't say that for some reason.
I'll go with Jason.
Why we should pronounce things like the Chinese? All of a sudden, everybody's saying Porsche. I've been saying Porsche all my life, and I'm not changing.
Now, the similarity between that and the Range Rover, is that such an issue? Because all cars look the blooming same to my eyes today. I mean, the front of an Aston Martin looks pretty much the same as the front of a Ford Mondeo, doesn't it?
Well, of course, that's because they have to compete with each other, and people will look at stats in terms of sort of performance and miles per whatever unit of energy you're using, and there is an optimum shape for a car. I mean, you know, the days when a Citroën looked mad and an Audi looked blobby and a BMW was three boxes are long gone. They're all the same size and shape because that's the optimum size for a motor car. And it makes sense, really.
Should we get used to not building British cars anymore?
We haven't built British cars for 40 years. Get used to it.
We do build cars, though, but they're not for us. They're for foreign companies that have set up factories here. I mean, the only British car I could find, and I might be even wrong about this, is the Caterham. Are there any others?
Well, I don't think Caterham are exactly... I think Morgan.
No, I think Morgan is Italian now, isn't it?
Oh, no.
I think so.
I've given up on that. I've completely given up on that. In a way, it was kind of a good thing, because we got it out of our system in the old days of kind of when the government had to step in because it was so disastrous and they had to put most of the British car manufacturers under the same umbrella, which they call British Leyland. That all happened 40 plus years ago, and it was a disaster. It didn't mean that we have to face the situation that the Germans are in today. Today I was reading German media, quite an odd thing to do on a Sunday, but I was. And they are, well, I better be careful what I say. They are running scared. Because they know Volkswagen Group, Audi, BMW, Mercedes, cars, motors are still a huge part of the German economy, between 20 and 25%, depending on who you listen to. The Chinese are coming for their market. 3 years ago, I sat in a dinner in a very expensive hotel in London, and I found myself sat next to a guy who has a company business up here in the northwest of England, very well known, selling volume cars. Family cars, not fancy stuff, not luxury cars, not sports cars. Volume cars that are made in Germany. He was approached by the biggest name in Chinese cars in the UK right now, and they said to him, we want you to stop selling those German cars and sell our cars. And he said, well, I don't think I want to do that. He said, Steve, when they told me how much money I was going to make, how cheaply the cars were going to be supplied to me, and how much money I was going to make, I had a good old think about it. And they said, he said to them, look, you can't be making money at this, at these prices. And they said, we don't care. We want the volume car market in the whole world. And we are prepared to put in, and you know, the Koreans did it 25 years ago. The Japanese did it 35 years ago. They're not making a lot of money on these cars because people are thinking, how can they sell it for this price? Well, they can sell it for the price that they're selling it at because they don't expect to make much of a profit to begin with. But they want the volume car market around the whole world, not just in our little islands, and they're going to have it.
I mean, it's curious that it's coming from a communist country, but I mean, that is how capitalism works, isn't it? You provide a good that is better than the competition at a price that people like, and you win.
Well, guess how many car companies there are in China, Nick?
4.
130.
I was close.
You were close. This is what people think, and they are absolutely cutting each other's throats. I love the history of cars and motorcycles, particularly. I'm a motorcycle man, really. Man does not exist by motorcycle alone in this modern world, so I have to dip my toe into the car world a lot of the time. There have been hundreds of motorcycle manufacturers in the UK, but the ones that people know are Triumph, BSA and Norton, who all weirdly still exist right now in 2026, even though it's Indian money propping it up, or it's money that's come from somewhere else to prop up what is supposed to be the British bike industry. But the big three, Triumph, Norton and BSA, back in the day, were the biggest motorcycle manufacturers in the world, and they sold off all the little guys. And that's what's happening in China now. They've got 130 companies making cars, and they are all cutting each other's throats. But the Chinese government's letting them do it because it's the survival of the fittest. I knew a Chinese fishmonger, yes I did, and he did that. He told me he did that with his eels. He put them all in the same tub, alive. He didn't feed them, so that when his customers came, they'd say, do you feed your eels? He'd say no, because they knew they were getting the strongest ones. And that's why the Chinese government is allowing all these car firms to proliferate with massive cutthroat competition, because it knows that only the strongest ones will survive, and they'll be able to go out in the world and lay waste to the volume car industry everywhere else. Volkswagen, Ford, Nissan, Toyota, people are going to be absolutely astonished at what's going to happen in cars. And I'm telling you, it's moving at China speed. Have you heard that saying, China speed?
No, that's the first for me.
Well, they say, when you go to China and they've built a city since you were last there 2 years ago, people have got, oh yeah, China speed. And that's what's happening with cars. We talk about this. Will we be able to get used to it? We'd better get used to it, because it's going to happen before 2030.
But are the Chinese able to produce these cars of such high spec and such low price because they are being essentially subsidised by the Chinese state?
No. They're able to do it because they lead the world in technology. Have you not noticed? Wait, have you got a mega up-to-date smartphone like the latest, greatest? Where do you think that was made? Wales. We sitting here in England, you and I are having a conversation like it's 1968, and we're going, have you seen these new Honda motorcycles? They can't possibly be as good as my Norton. Well, they blinking well were, the Japanese ones, weren't they? And that's what devastated Britain's volume car industry. Then the Koreans came along and said, hey, we're really good at making things. I was just watching a movie, and a fantastic movie in 4K on my Korean giant TV just before I was speaking to you. They are really good at making things. So they had a go. And obviously Kia are a big part of the UK volume car market. We're good in the UK at making cars like the Caterham that you just mentioned. And we've still got, Aston Martin, McLaren, you see Gordon Ramsay pulling up in his Aston Martin Valkyrie. Then you remember that Aston Martin have gone bankrupt 5 times in their history. There's no money in making those supercars, Only people who make money. So we've got Bentley and we've got Rolls-Royce, they're foreign owned. But there's no need to worry about the British car industry because they're really... To be honest, there really isn't one.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if we've actually come to regret the decision taken by Margaret Thatcher to turn the country away from manufacturing and concentrate on financial services. But in the long run, it might have actually done us a favour.
Well, Nick, I'm talking to you from Manchester, the world's first industrial city. And I'm from the north side, from Bury, a little town 8 miles north of the city of Manchester. And when I was a kid, there were 20-odd paper mills. But it was a paper town. East Lancs, Bibby's, Wiles, Transparent, Olives. There were paper mills all over the town of Bury. Where were the raw materials coming from? I'll tell you where they were coming from. Canada. The endless forests of Canada. Now, what kind of sense that would make in the modern world? People, all of a sudden, people went, why are we shipping these trees halfway around the world? This is stupid. And it's... Everyone has their moment, don't they? Everyone has their moment where they're able to make... Well, not everyone, but they're able to make things cheaper, more effectively, and at a better price point. And one of the good things is that we, as you said, long ago, we gave up really trying to have a British volume car manufacturing industry. And I'll never forget the day that my dad came home with a Datsun. Do you remember when they were called a Datsun, not a Nissan?
Mm-hmm.
And even as a kid of like, I must have been 10, 11 years old, I got in it. It was a Datsun 120 F2 fastback. It had a vinyl roof. It had hubcaps. It had an in-out aerial. It had a radio cassette player as standard and a revvy little 1200 engine. And do you know what it was better than? It was better than the bloody Hillman Hunter that he'd replaced. Much better.
I bet it was better than the Hillman Imp, which is what I first had.
Hey, the Hillman Imp was killed off by Skoda Lada. The Imp sold on the fact that it was the cheapest car you could buy in the UK. And, of course, people saw an opportunity there and brought Skodas and Ladas. Isn't it weird that we were kind of pointing nuclear weapons at each other? It was the Cold War was at its height, and they said, do you want some of our cars?
This is one of the things that people are talking about now, that one of the reasons that some people are concerned about the preponderance of Chinese cars on the road is they're talking about the security issues that they might... with the chips that are on board cars these days start spying on us and so on.
Yeah.
There was this panic about buses a little while ago, which had the ability to be switched off remotely. And so that was considered a security concern. Do you buy any of that?
Well, I'm worried because if people know that Bill from Bolton is actually seeing Sheila from the canteen behind his wife's back... in Beijing, then I'm sure that they'll process that information. I was telling you I was sat next to that car executive. Well, at another similar dinner, I ended up sat next to a copper, quite a senior policeman, and he told me that the police can track your phone, even when it's switched off.
Well, that's the bizarre thing, that the phone, like you said, is made in China, even if it's not even if it's not a Chinese brand, and that knows more about us than we know about us. I don't really see the panic about the Chinese cars, other than they're taking our lunch.
They're not taking anybody's lunch. Everybody has their, everybody has their moment in the sun, I think. And we had ours, and it was great, and we still make some fantastic cars in this country. The, you know, Rolls-Royce, Bentley, Aston Martin, McLaren, Morgan, Ariel, all sorts of very low-volume, very high-end, very specialist car manufacturing. We're still more or less the home of Formula One, which is the absolute pinnacle of motorsport. Well, it wasn't until this year. Let's not talk about this year. Let's just draw a veil over what's happening in Formula One, as I'm sure Formula One will. But, yeah, the good thing is that the people that I speak to that have bought a BYD or they bought an... here's the thing, Nick. I drive, my daily driver is an MG, but it's not a modern one. It's a real one. It was made in Abingdon by people called Bill and Ian and Derek. It wasn't...
Because the modern one is Chinese as well. It's hard to pick a car. I mean, all the ones that you've mentioned, they might get built here, but they're not owned by people who live here, that's for sure.
Yeah, but that's the nature of the world now, isn't it? It's kind of when people think, oh, what's... But like I said, back in the day, people would say, oh, I've got a British car, I've got a Vauxhall. You go, who owns Vauxhall? Who bought Vauxhall in 1929? I'll tell you who bought Vauxhall. General Motors of Detroit. So quite how you think that your car's British, I don't know. All I know is this. Everybody I know that's bought a Jayco or a BYD or a Geely or whatever it is has said to me, do you know what, Steve? It's fantastic. And they are. For the money, for once, the consumer is getting a fantastic product at a very keen price. Well, and I know it's not great for the industry, and I know that they are howling because of what's going on, but the group that's really benefiting from this are people who are in the market and in a lucky position to be able to afford a new car, because boy, oh boy, oh boy, are you getting value for money.
Steve, very good to talk to you. Thanks so much for that. That's Steve Berry, the motoring journalist and former Top Gear presenter. So is he right? Are Chinese cars fantastic? Or when you're in one, does it feel a bit like you've bought a battery and someone who doesn't know much about cars has fashioned a body around it? This concern about security as well. Are we becoming too reliant on China? Would you be concerned about buying a Chinese car because of the security issues? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
LBC.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK, so we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
OK, who's all in for Cancer Research UK's Race for Life?
We're doing pretty muddy.
It's an obstacle course.
There's one for kids.
Runners.
Walkers.
Book clubbers.
Knit clubbers.
Tenpin bowlers.
Choir singers.
Lake swimmers.
Gardeners.
Whether you climb it.
Slide it.
Or crawl it.
Go all in against cancer.
All in to help fund life-saving research. Sign up now and save 50% off entry to your local 3K, 5K, 10K or Pretty Muddy event. Search Race for Life. Discount ends April 19th, 2026. T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So apparently the best-selling car in this country at the moment is a Jayco or Jayco. I'm not very sure, but I think pretty soon we'll all be familiar with how you pronounce that name, because there's going to be so many of them on our roads. Looks a bit like a Range Rover, but it doesn't cost like a Range Rover. It's about half the price. So they've had to cut something. It can't possibly be as good as a Range Rover, or can it? 0345 6060 973. Toulouse, Richard.
Good evening.
Richard.
I'm looking at buying a hybrid, but if I can come back a stage, the UK and Europe are faced with a fuel crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And rising fuel prices. And I would urge the British government and Europe to look at opening their doors to as many Chinese hybrids as possible in the short term, or at least until this crisis is over. Because if we can get people using less fuel, then the financial impact will be reduced. The amount we have to import by way of fuel will be reduced, and that will be better for the balance of payments. But going to onto a stage about what car to buy, obviously your needs change. I am now retired. I need to carry a family of five round as and when we're all together. I'm looking at buying a small family car, and price-wise, I've just been looking at a Peugeot 208, which is about €21,000 for a hybrid.
Yeah.
And that's not the basic model, it's slightly above that. But I've been looking at BYD, I've talked to them. And unfortunately for them, their people haven't got back to me, so they obviously have a service problem. It might just be for people who are 66 and I may not hit their criteria.
It could have just been a coincidence. Maybe your phone message or email got lost, but...
funnily enough, the exchange I had was with... a bot on their website, and they took all the details down, but they haven't responded.
Okay.
So that's their loss.
They
but I
don't
have to
get
say,
your
to
business.
To be fair to them, I was up in Scotland for a couple of weeks, and we used a BYD car, which was, an MG in name only.
Yeah.
But... whilst I might make fun of it in those terms, it was a very nice car to drive.
The new MG is a very good-looking car. I mean, those SUVs, there isn't many of them that look different. And I'd say two of them that really do are the Lamborghini, which is outside most people's ability to buy, and the very similar-looking MG.
Hmm. Well, I haven't seen that one, but I've certainly driven the MG that BYD are parading in Scotland at the moment.
Right. Well, I'm unfamiliar
and
with that.
What you should also know is that in order to get into Europe in a big way, they have actually had to reduce the spec of their vehicles so that they
reduce. Why?
Because the Europeans don't want the public to experience the kind of luxury at a low-end price.
Oh, you mean they've been forced to reduce them?
Yes,
right.
Absolutely. You also were talking about security. I can tell you, I am far, far more concerned about the British government allowing AI to infiltrate every area of our defence, NHS, and other aspects of government, because it is controlled from America by Trump.
Hmm. Well, not necessarily by by Trump personally, but certainly by his donors.
Hang on a minute. Yes, by Trump. He issued a presidential decree in which he demanded the U.S. manufacturers of AI ensure that no wokeness was allowed.
Well, that does sound like something that Donald Trump would say, but I think his control over AI is as naught, because even the people that are making AI don't seem to be able to control it. But that is for another day, although AI is going to be part of these cars, and that is one of the things that people seem to be concerned about. Thanks for that, Richard. You will recall a little while ago, this was panic about Chinese-made buses and their onboard software. All vehicles now apparently have to have a chip in there that is connected to the internet so that the car can have updates over the air and that sort of thing. And there was this bizarre story about people were freaking out because we had put in an order for a lot of Chinese-made buses and their onboard software was vulnerable, so they said, to malign Chinese control. And it occurred to me that, I mean, what are they going to do? Just turn the engine off? Well, then people would have to walk the rest of the way home. Is that such a big deal? And it seems unlikely that the Chinese are going to flick an off switch on the vehicles they sell because they want to sell more of them, don't they? Are we getting into something of a panic about Chinese cars? And if you're in the market for a car, have you been persuaded to buy one of those, despite the fact that it does appear to be destroying what is left of our car industry, most of which, right enough, is building cars for foreign companies. But, you know, there's a lot of people who work in that industry in this country. And the more Chinese cars or more Chinese-made cars that we buy, then the fewer people that will be needed in that homegrown industry. 0345-6060-973. And if you've got a Chinese car, what's it like? Going to take a break for the news, after which the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has conceded the Hungarian election, ending 16 years in power. News footage is showing large-scale street parties across Budapest as both Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin have lost a key European ally. We will get the word from a man who is at the scene in Budapest after the news update with Tim Daly.
US Central Command says its blockade of the Strait of Hormuz will begin at 3 p.m. UK time tomorrow. It was announced earlier on today by President Trump after the failure of peace talks with Iran in Pakistan. The Liberal Democrats say they'll be making a call in Parliament tomorrow for a cut in fuel duty after large price rises caused by the war in Iran. The party says it will table a motion demanding an immediate reduction of 10 pence on every litre. And Viktor Orban, the right-wing leader of Hungary, has conceded defeat in the country's general election. He's been governing for the last 16 years, but has now lost to a centre-right opponent. LBC weather, sporadic and isolated showers will break out across the UK overnight. They'll be at their heaviest and most concentrated in northern and northwestern Scotland. We'll see a low in some areas of around 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
Listeners, we interrupt the airways to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
The weather's warmer, the days are longer, and the savings are even better in the Hillary's Spring Sale. Right now, there's up to 40% off hundreds of made-to-measure styles. Plus, get an extra 10% off everything in our flash event, including our total blackout blinds for complete darkness and a good night's sleep. And don't forget, with Hillary's, measuring and fitting is always included. So get window wise and book your free in-home appointment today at hillarys.co.uk. But hurry, an extra 10% off everything ends the 13th of April. Conditions apply.
Next.
Hi, just these, thanks. Do you do cashback?
Just need to check you're not a robot first. New security policy.
Okay.
How many traffic lights can you see out the window?
Two?
No, that's wrong.
Right, well, obviously I'm not a robot.
That's what a robot would say.
What a load of malarkey. Smarty keeps things simple, like 80 gigabytes for £10. And on a rolling monthly SIM plan, you're free to leave any time. Less malarkey, more Smarty. Search Smarty Mobile.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
More of your thoughts on the influx of Chinese cars on our roads to come, but let's talk about what has happened in Hungary. Martin Dunaj is the Southeast Europe correspondent for the Financial Times. He is in Budapest and joins us on the line now. Hello, Martin.
Hello, how you doing?
Very well, thanks. So, this Peter Magyar, who is he? What do we know about him?
He is a 45-year-old lawyer, former insider of the ruling party, a former ruling party, I don't know how should I say it, of Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who 2 years ago, at the start of some very nasty child sex abuse scandals, broke with the party and started his own new movement, which in 2 years he has built up into a force that just tonight won a two-thirds constitutional majority in Hungary. This is completely unprecedented in a vote that attracted nearly 80% of eligible voters in Hungary, which is a massive record. And right now, I'm in the middle of a fairly massive street party on the banks of the Danube, directly opposing the House of Parliament, where thousands of young people are celebrating the end of the Orban era right now.
Yes, you say young people. Was the vote demarcated by age, do you think?
Well, it is 12:30 in the morning, so yes. Oh. but in terms of voting composition, of course, it's a very universal cross-section of society. I mean, well over 3 million people voted for Magyar, from small towns to big cities, from old people to young people, men, women, students, workers, you name it. So it is one of those massive popular landslides, textbook one.
Now, J.D. Vance recently visited the country in order to boost Orban's chances. What was the actual effect of Vance's appearance?
One day after Vance left the country, I went to the eastern corner of the country and asked people about that. When I said, so what do you think about J.D. Vance's support for Orban? And the answer was, J.D. who? And so people don't really know who he is and really don't give a damn about what he says. And in all honesty, when J.D. Vance was here, he reinforced a lot of the old talking points of Orban, but it was nothing new. He didn't offer anything that was really groundbreaking. It sounded like a much more powerful version of Orban himself. And because Orban is so deeply, obviously, as shown by the result, discrediting in Hungary at this point, it didn't really count for too much.
Well, if they haven't heard of J.D. Vance, they'll certainly have heard of Donald Trump, and he threw his weight behind Viktor Orban. Did it actually work against Orban?
Not really. What you see in Western Europe as this deep-seated antipathy towards Trump, not even that is really an issue in Hungary. What really decided the elections was domestic stuff, bread and butter issues, the economy. If anything resonated with Hungarian voters in terms of foreign policy, it was this deep-seated fear of the Russians. And Orban obviously wanted to deflect that in trying to blame Ukraine for all evil in Hungary. But people saw through that, and they really really perceived Vladimir Putin's Russia for being the threat that it really is. And you could see that when TISA marched at the opposition TISA party, which just won the elections, their marches went through town. When they passed by the Russian embassy, spontaneously they began to chant, "Russians go home, Russians go home," which was the same chant that they used in 1989 when communism fell.
The relationship between the European Union and Hungary has been strained. How do you think that's going to play out?
That's going to take a 180 turn, I think, overnight. I mean, Peter Magyar promised to reset relations with the European Union. And that's not only a campaign promise. He very much needs to do that to restart the Hungarian economy. Hungary needs to unfreeze about 20 billion euros worth of funds that the EU has blocked because of corruption concerns and rule of law concerns. And on top of that, Maidar also wants to unlock 16 billion euros worth of military development funds, which were also held up in Brussels. Hungary is the last country that still has not received the green light from the EU to use those monies. So in total, that is 36 billion euros in a country whose GDP is barely over 200. So these are fairly substantial financial incentives for him to actually deeply and then substantially reset the relationship with the European Union and the broader West in general, including the UK.
Those kind of sums will produce a sugar rush to the economy. Do we know what sort of leader Magyar is going to be as far as the economy is concerned in the future?
If his choices of the economic leadership are any indication, I think he's going to be a responsible one. He named a banker with decades of experience to lead the finance ministry, and he tapped one of the former vice presidents of Shell to lead the energy ministry. He has very experienced people around him. So it's not just his own credentials, but the credentials of the people that he chose. And it seems like he chooses his people well.
What's his position on personal freedom, the treatment of minorities and so on? Do you think that ordinary Hungarians are going to feel a difference in their everyday lives?
Hopefully. I mean, that's probably much more of a long-term process. I mean, Orban has set Hungary's cultural and political norms for so long that it'll take quite some time to reverse that. But if where I'm standing is any indication, again, I'm surrounded by a lot of celebrating young people who are all about love for all. So it does seem like Peter Magyar's slogan, which is do not be afraid, is already reverberating across Hungary.
Martin, thanks very much for that. Appreciate your time. Martin Dunaj, the Southeast Europe correspondent for the Financial Times, speaking to us there live from Budapest. Now, let's restart our conversation about Chinese-made cars, because they had the number one selling car in this country in the last month. It's a hybrid-powered SUV, which famously looks very like the Range Rover, but does not cost like the Range Rover. And because Chinese cars are becoming so numerous on our roads, some people are concerned that there are security implications about spying on people within their cars and collating information about us and so on. I wonder if you share some of those concerns. Darby, hello, Brent.
Hello, my friend. I've got a wee Chinese car for the last 2.5 years, actually, believe it or not, and service charges are low when you have to change the tires. It's fantastic. It drives brilliantly, very low-tech in the sense that it doesn't have the bells and whistles on the inside. But the drivability, and it's just fantastic. The only thing I'd sort of say is in the wintertime, the range does go down a little bit with the cold weather. And you do get a little bit of, you know, obviously they caught with the charging, but you build the infrastructure around it, and I can't complain. Brilliant idea.
Some people have said that it does feel as though you've just bought a car from a battery company, that they don't really make cars like they do in Germany, for instance. There's the drivability, the sort of excitement is not perhaps the right word, but the sort of it of driving isn't there. You're just sort of wafting around, sort of disconnected from the road.
Not really. I mean, I traded in a BMW hybrid, believe it or not, and purchased a brand new electric car for the trade-in of a second-hand BMW, ironically. So we talk about affordability. It was reasonably affordable, in a sense, what I was trading in. And the drivability, yes, it doesn't have the same amount of bells and whistles that my previous car did. But I'll be honest with you, the driving is fantastic. The zoom you get out of it, the instant torque you get in an electric car, is like driving a go-kart. It's fantastic. It's like one of those ski electrics when you were a kid, you know? You remember you used to come off the track when you were on the ski electrics. You literally get that level of acceleration. So, no, I disagree that the... and you talk about trusting. Do I trust, you know, anything made by Elon Musk? Really? you know, we had the same problem in the 1980s when we all of a sudden we had Japanese cars coming on the market and people were like, what's a Toyota? And then we just went with it. And by they made great cars, reliable cars for their time. It's just the natural evolution of things, isn't it, really?
And what kind of car have you got?
MG4.
Right. So that's, is that the SUV, the relatively new one that's just come out?
No. So it's one of the sort of hatchback sort of family cars, yeah.
Right.
I've got the entry-level model, and I'm happy with the entry-level model, and the models that are coming in after this are even faster, longer, you know, things. So I've got the basic model, to be honest with you, and there are people driving the higher spec model. So I'm only happy with the basic model. I can only say that people who've got the higher spec models must be extremely happy.
And it does seem a bit bizarre to be talking about MG as being a Chinese car, because, of course, it didn't used to be. But then Jaguar didn't used to be owned by India, and Mini and Rolls-Royce didn't used to be German, and Bentley didn't used to be German, and Lotus didn't used to be Chinese, and Vauxhall didn't used to be Dutch, and Aston Martin didn't used to be Canadian, Saudi Arabian, Chinese and German.
Well, and electricity companies, our power companies, our water companies, our banks, you know, what's left, it is actually, you could say, it's British HP sauce. How's the bottom of sauce made in Holland?
You know? Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Let's be clear. I mean, it's Britain that opened the door to this, the way of the world and capitalism. So it's Darwinian when you think about it, what's happening. But then, as your guest is saying, you know, this is what are we to do? Stick in the past and drive around in a Model T Ford? I don't think so. You know what I mean? And especially the last couple of weeks, I'm not been saying I'm going in the smoke boat, but watching the price of fuel as I drive by, I go, that's not a problem for me, is it really?
Yeah. So, that's a nice position to be in. All right, good talking to you, Brent. Thanks for that. 0345-6060-973. Yeah, there isn't really much that's British anymore, is there? I mean, I tried to find some things that really are associated with Britain that are still owned by British companies. And I can't really come up with very much. I mean, I just gave you the list of the cars that are very associated with Britain that aren't British anymore, like Rolls-Royce, for instance, Bentley, Jaguar, and so on, Vauxhall. But there's... The other things that you think are British aren't either. Cadbury's, American. Walker's Crisps, American. Waterston's, American. Boots, American. Harrods, Qatari. Sarson's Vinegar, the sauce for our chips, Japanese. Weetabix, Chinese. Birdseye, American. As is Andrex. Tetley Tea is Indian, so at least there's some sense to that. 0345-6060-973. Have you considered buying a Chinese car? And if you bought one, I'd be very interested to see what your experience has been like. 0345-6060-973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The day a dance class turned into a murder scene.
There has been a knife attack on a property in Hart Street. This is getting very serious indeed. I think we should be bracing ourselves.
The killings of three innocent girls at a Taylor Swift themed class left a nation asking how such an atrocity could ever have been committed. Last year, justice was delivered.
I sentence him to custody for life with a minimum term which he must serve in custody of 52 years. It is highly likely that he will never be released.
Next week, the chance for further accountabilities as the Southport Inquiry publishes its Phase 1 report. The red flags, the missed opportunities, will it bring the answers the families and a country so desperately deserve?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
You know what you're getting with a wedding? Wedding hats. A baby in a waistcoat crying throughout the vows. Themed tables. Awkward best man speech. The plus one.
Hello.
People dancing in a circle. Ruined rental suit. Sometimes in life you just know what you're getting. Like a luxury bed and a great night's sleep. You know what you're getting with Premier Inn.
The weather's warmer, the days are longer, and the savings are even better in the Hillary's Spring Sale. Right now, there's up to 40% off hundreds of made-to-measure styles. Plus, get an extra 10% off everything in our flash event, including our total blackout blinds for complete darkness and a good night's sleep. And don't forget, with Hillary's, measuring and fitting is always included. So get window wise and book your free in-home appointment today at hillarys.co.uk. But hurry, an extra 10% off everything ends the 13th of April. Conditions apply.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK, so we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
We are talking about the surprising rise of Chinese cars. Go back a few years and there just really weren't any on the roads. Now they're everywhere. Have you experienced a Chinese car? And if you've been put off by some of the security concerns, what is it about that that has made you think again? Bromley. Hello, Luke.
Nick, good evening. Luke. Can I just start by saying the 10 till 10.22pm segment, best radio I've heard in the whole
process. 10 till 10.22?
Yeah, you're actually...
You know what?
Fantastic.
Well, I appreciate that, Luke. This is a very, very bad line. You're perhaps not talking to me on a Chinese-made phone. We're going to call Luke back and see if we can get a better line, yes? Newcastle. Hello, Chandra.
Very good evening, Nick.
Chandra.
I'm going to make a slightly unusual point in relation to this discussion.
Yes.
I happen to be a civil engineer, and 20-odd years ago when China started building high-speed rail infrastructure, there was a lot of criticism in the West, including British media, and there were predictions that there'll be the pace and the manner in which they built the infrastructure. There were observations, expert observations, more or less saying that we'll see lots of accidents and so on.
Yeah.
There has only been one major incident in the last 15-20 years. In China, involving Chinese high-speed rail network, whereas there have been many more in Europe over the same period. My point
is that not comparing like with like, though, because the European railway system predates the Chinese one, does it not? I mean, something that's newer is less likely to break down.
Well, actually, the criticism that was levied when they were starting off was that they've built it so quickly and so in such haste,
right,
that things will start breaking apart very soon.
Mm.
And especially when you build bridges, the criticism was around the manner in which the bridges, we are talking hundreds of kilometers of bridge network and tunnels.
Yes.
They had to create in a very short span of time.
Yeah, I remember that there was one bridge, I can't remember the name of it, but it was apparently the tallest bridge, if not in the world, then certainly in China. It was absolutely remarkable how the valley beneath it was so deep. And
yeah.
They put a restaurant in one of the towers and a rainbow-making waterfall off the side of the bridge, and they constructed it in the same period of time that it took to make a roundabout on the embankment at Vauxhall.
Wow. I'm not surprised. What I'm trying to get at is that there are many areas where China deserves criticism. Their human rights record... And the secrecy with which they operate sometimes is worth criticism. But we have to give them credit, and we have to give them, we have to afford them the dignity they deserve for what they do in areas where they're really good.
But do you think they can only achieve that because they have completely free rein to treat their workers as they wish, whereas we are somewhat constrained in the West because of, you know, the rights of workers?
There is so much to unpack there, Nick. I mean, if we were to look at one car, obviously we can question them and criticize them on their human rights record, which is attached to their ability to make things cheaply. But what we cannot use that, we cannot use the same argument and diminish the quality of their article. In technical terms, it's either good or bad.
Mm.
It cannot be technically bad because it's being made by slave labor.
Right. No, I get so, that. It becomes a moral argument. But are the cars actually good? I mean, do you have experience of them?
Well, I would think they do. Yeah.
So you don't. So you don't have experience of them.
Well, which is the reason I said I'm going to make a slightly sidestepping
right.
argument.
Okay.
Can I just make the second point and let you in peace? The second point I've almost forgotten. No, but I got it back. This thing about spying. My phone, which is made by Samsung, is listening to me. My laptop, which has got Microsoft in it, is following everything I do. And my every time I search something on Google, Google is reporting to its headquarters. We live in an age, and it's not just now. Everybody is noticing what the other is doing.
I think that we have very different attitudes to security depending on what it is that we're talking about. People were concerned about the security of the Chinese made buses, that they might have a kill switch that the Chinese could operate. Why they would do that, I've absolutely no idea. But people were so concerned about it that I think an order was stopped. People are concerned about the computer chips in Chinese cars, because they may be, you know, tracking your movements or listening to your conversations and so on. But people don't seem to be remotely concerned about the greatest spying device that has ever been invented by humankind, which is the phone in your pocket. It knows everything about you. It knows where you were on October the 10th, 5 years ago, at 7:32 in the evening. It knows where you were, who you were talking to, what you were doing, how you got there, how you got back, how fast you were going when you were going back and forth. There isn't anything it doesn't know about you. So it seems a bit bizarre to be this concerned about the Chinese cars spying on you. I think it is the homegrown industry which is somewhat freaked out about this new competition. Luke is back. Hello, Luke.
Hi, Nick.
Yes,
I'm back. Right, well, I wouldn't touch a Chinese car with a barge pole or even a chopstick. Before anyone says I'm being dramatic, let's just look back, take a step back. Modern cars aren't cars anymore. Basically, smartphones and wheels. They've got cameras inside, cameras outside, microphones, GPS tracking, Bluetooth syncing, and all this stuff. It just goes on. So the question isn't, do they collect data? Because they all do.
Yes.
The question is, where does that data go?
Right.
And who can access it? And here's where it gets uncomfortable, because in China, companies are legally required to cooperate with state military and state intelligence if asked.
Yes.
That's not a conspiracy theory, you see.
Well, as are our companies. If the intelligence services required our companies to hand over whatever they've got on whoever they've got it on, I'm sure that they would be required to do that by law.
Yeah, sure. But even if the car company is absolutely, completely innocent, they don't ultimately control the state. The government comes knocking, which they do regularly, so the way they operate, you know.
But what would it matter? I mean, what information is it that your phone doesn't get on you that your car would?
I'm not saying anyone in Beijing is listening to your chat about what you say or what you had for dinner, but basically when you scale it up, thousands upon millions of vehicles all over the place, suddenly you've got patterns of movement, locations, behaviour, and yes, you only need to look at 2 weeks ago when they had 150 vehicles in Wuhan, was it, city of China, they all stopped immediately.
Did did they?
And froze. Yeah, and it froze people in their cars for up to 2 hours. And they didn't just stop or not start. They literally were going 60 miles an hour down the motorway, highway, and they froze. So they slammed on there because cars were going in the back of them and all sorts. No one was badly injured because they all had seatbelts on. But that's the sort of thing that can happen to these automated cars, you know?
Well, I was unfamiliar with that story, but that does sound alarming. Thanks for that, Luke. Let me see if I can squeeze one more in before the news. Aldershot. Hello, Nigel.
Good evening, Nick.
Yes, sir.
3 weeks ago, I bought an MG ZS Hybrid.
Oh, yes.
And I'm an ex-test driver for Formula One companies, Top Gear, and I absolutely love it.
Now, is this the MG that looks a bit like a Lamborghini, the SUV?
Yes, in sense.
Right.
Just something very quickly, your last caller.
Yeah.
Hastings Direct, British company, track all of your information on your insurance policy. But anyway, my MG, I filled it up the other day, £45, and up popped on the digital screen, I've got 526 miles to do before I run out.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. It's the best car I've ever owned or ever driven. It's just phenomenal.
What about its the sort of experience of driving itself? Because, you know, some German companies pride themselves on their, you know, the ultimate driving machine, they say. That some people have said that Chinese cars, you feel a bit sort of detached from your surroundings.
No, not at all. It's got all the bells and whistles in it. If I really want to, I can put it in what's called normal mode. So I've got eco mode, normal mode and sport. Put it in normal mode, 0 to 60 in 2 seconds.
No.
Yes.
Two?
If you want, I'll come up to Leicester Square and take you for a drive.
Nigel, you'd lose your licence in 3 seconds, but thanks for the offer. All right, thanks for all of that. We're going to move on after the news. Golden Eagles could soon soar over English skies once again. Their 2-metre wingspans were once common, even in Shakespeare's time. But centuries of persecution by gamekeepers and farmers have driven them out of England. The last native bird lived in England died in the Lake District just a few years ago. And now a new study has identified 8 potential recovery zones in the north where populations could thrive. The release of young Scottish eagles could start as early as next year. Does the sign of such majestic birds fill you with excitement? And are there other animals that we should try to reintroduce? And also, are there some animals that have been introduced that should be removed?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. U.S. Central Command says its blockade of the Strait of Hormuz will begin at 3 o'clock this afternoon, UK time. It was announced on Sunday by President Trump after the failure of peace talks with Iran in Pakistan. But the former U.S. Navy intelligence officer, Malcolm Nance, has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC, Iran won't just give up its plan to control the strait and charge for access.
They will, in a year, make $160 billion. That's more profit than the actual oil in the Strait of Hormuz. The toll booth is far more profitable. This is madness. This war, the United States has lost this war. And Iran is making bank.
It's being reported a government official has said the UK will not be involved in Donald Trump's plan to blockade the Strait of Hormuz. The US president has claimed other nations will play a part, while also saying British minesweepers will be sent to the shipping lane. Oil prices have risen above $100 a barrel again this morning during early trading on the Asian markets. They dip for a time following the announcement of a 2-week ceasefire between the US and Iran. A record turnout in Hungary's prime ministerial election has resulted in the victory of Viktor Orban's pro-EU opponent, Peter Magyar. Mr. Orban conceded defeat on Sunday evening and had been criticised for aligning himself with both President Trump and Vladimir Putin. The LBC presenter and foreign affairs expert, Matt Fry, believes his departure is not much of a surprise.
Orban has presided over 16 years
a very charismatic, increasingly authoritarian rule in which Hungary has slipped to the bottom of just about every indicator of wealth in the European Union and to the top of just about every indicator of corruption.
The trade union Unison is claiming at least 21,000 NHS jobs will be cut in England between now and 2028. It says the posts will be closed as trusts look to balance their books. The Department of Health and Social Care says an extra £26 billion has been invested in the health service. And in sports, and in the last few minutes, Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy has won the 90th Masters at Augusta National to defend his title. He finished in front of the American Scottie Scheffler. LBC weather, sporadic and isolated showers will break out across the UK overnight. They'll be at their most prevalent over northern and northwestern Scotland. We'll see a low in some districts of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Guardian reports that the Golden Eagle, which has largely been absent from the country's skies, with only a handful of pairs seen in the last 150 years, is about to be reintroduced. It's not as though you could miss it. It's got a 2-metre wingspan, but has been effectively extinct in England since the last one is thought to have died in 2015. But a new study by Forestry England found that England now has the capacity to sustain golden eagle populations once again. Well, let's talk about this and related issues with George Monbiot. George is the Guardian columnist and environmental campaigner, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, George.
Hi there, Nick. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. What do you know about this study by Forestry England? What is it that led them to conclude that we can now that we can now sustain a population of golden eagles in England?
Well, the truth is we've always been able to sustain them. The only thing which has stopped the golden eagles from being able to live here is that gamekeepers and farmers have been killing them. And that's because they blame golden eagles for eating lambs, in the case of farmers, and for eating various things that people want to shoot, in the case of gamekeepers. And so it's really the persecution which stops them from living here. There's always been enough for them to feed on. There's been nesting places. It's perfectly possible to have golden eagles living in England again.
So it's the problem with us, as far as our relationship with golden eagles, is that the golden eagles were killing things before we could.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it was always exaggerated. You know, it's a very small proportion ever of lambs, for instance, which get killed by the golden eagles. And in fact, golden eagles eat a lot of foxes, which might also be eating lambs. And so it probably balances out. And the trouble is, you know, that people just see one lamb being taken and say, right, that eagle has got to die. Whereas, you know, what you can do is to have a compensation scheme and say, yep, you know, we don't want your lambs to be eaten by golden eagles, but if they are, we will pay you for that lamb, and we will make sure that you don't lose out as a result. And, you know, I do think that the majority of people would love to see this amazing, beautiful, magnificent bird in our skies again. And one of the best experiences I have when I go to Scotland is seeing golden eagles. They are so uplifting. It makes your heart sing to see them, and I don't see why we should be deprived of that in England.
So just to press on this study, then, by Forestry England, did the study conclude that it would be okay because there is this compensation scheme?
Well, so I'm a bit sceptical about a study which says suddenly eagles could live here when they couldn't live here before. Because that is actually, you know, nothing has fundamentally changed, except that, you know, we could strike an agreement with farmers and gamekeepers that they're not going to kill them anymore. Now, you know, there's obviously always going to be illegal persecution. And unfortunately, gamekeepers in particular kill a lot of protected birds in England, particularly hen harriers, which are now a very rare bird of prey. And the gamekeepers kill them because they eat grouse. And you know, there's a lot of killing, a great deal of killing. Whenever you have a pheasant shoot or a grouse shoot or something, it's just all the predators in the area, they get killed. But, you know, we need to see the police clamping down on this. It's not legal to do so. And
And in the right political environment, the eagles can live here. The physical environment, the ecosystem, has been right for them forever. That's not the problem. It's the political environment is what counts.
Right. I mean, people might be a little alarmed, though, seeing a 2-metre-wide raptor, essentially, bearing down on them. Is it the kind of bird that would be frightened of humans, or has it got, is it smarter than that?
Yeah, I mean, there's never any problem between golden eagles and humans in Scotland or anywhere else that golden eagles live. And in fact, as it happens, we do have an even larger eagle living in England at the moment, which is the white-tailed eagle, which has been recently reintroduced here. Also an extraordinary, magnificent animal, even bigger than the golden eagle, and another part of our native fauna. But it would be lovely, just amazing, to see the golden eagles here as well. I mean, they might not be quite as big as the white-tailed eagles, but there's something very special about them. They've got a particular beauty, a beauty in the way they fly, a beauty in their strength, their magnificence. There's something, it's just irreplaceable. You know, you lose your eagles and you lose part of what your nation is.
You mentioned that there are some in Scotland. They had a pretty successful project to restore the populations in Scotland. And I believe that some of those birds have sort of crossed the border. They don't see the border. They don't know that there's one there. So yeah. Wouldn't they just expand naturally into England? Why would we need a project to help them expand?
Well, I mean, some do come over, as you say. They haven't been settling, and that could be partly because they don't find mates here. You know, one comes over, doesn't find a mate, goes back to Scotland. Another comes over, doesn't find a mate. So I think it does help to have a resident population established here. It also, you know, it helps to establish the precedent that we are going to have eagles living here again. It is illegal to kill them. You're committing a really antisocial as well as a criminal act if you kill one. And so we have a sort of wider tolerance of eagles in England, and that then makes it much more likely that eagles are able to stay here.
And what's the process of reintroducing them? Do they have to have a lot of sort of hands-on help from humans? And if so, might that actually work against them by them getting too used to us?
Well, there's always that danger, and that's a very interesting question that you raised. You know, you've got to make sure your bird isn't too habituated, as they call it. It's not too accustomed to the human presence, and, you know, does learn to hunt for itself and to be afraid of us. You know, you want them to keep a distance from people because they might get shot, and you don't want them to become dependent and be begging. They want to be out there hunting their own prey, their hares and the rabbits and the foxes and the other things that they eat, and so it's a subtle art. Reintroduction is not easy, but luckily there's a lot of very skilled professionals who have devoted their lives to working out how best to do it, and they've had tremendous successes in Britain and around the world in reintroducing missing species.
It seems somewhat counterintuitive, though, to reintroduce an animal that kills and eats other animals. To what extent are apex predators actually the key to a healthy ecosystem?
They're really important, and in fact, we do tend to have an oversupply of certain prey animals. Things are out of whack, and that's not just due to a lack of predators. So, for instance, you know, a lot of people complain, oh, there's far too many foxes around. Well, that's partly because we release 50 million pheasants into the countryside every year, an exotic species, which really doesn't make any contribution to our ecosystem, but the foxes love to eat those, and so you get the multiplication of foxes. Now, golden eagles come along, they could help redress that balance somewhat. And ecosystems do get out of balance without these apex predators, as you so rightly say. And they can be really critical for the health of an ecosystem.
What have we done to our ecosystem, though, that there's now the proliferation of species that essentially don't really belong here? They become invasive. Mm. I'm thinking of grey squirrels and parakeets and muntjacs, things like that.
Yeah, it is a huge problem. Now, some of these species are able to establish here because there's an ecological gap. For instance, grey squirrels were able to spread so easily because gamekeepers had killed pine martins, and pine martins are a very effective predator of grey squirrels. Grey squirrels in North America, they don't encounter pine martins, so they've got no mechanism for escaping from them. And once the pine martins are allowed to come back, then grey squirrels can suddenly be pushed away, and the red squirrels can come back. And this is what's happening in Ireland quite spectacularly at the moment. It's just a matter of gamekeepers killing fewer pine martins. The pine martins return. They can't catch the red squirrels so easily because the red squirrels are very small and light and get to the end of the twigs where the pine martins can't follow them. But the grey squirrels are great big heavy lumps, and they're basically meals on legs. And they very quickly, it's not just that they get eaten, but they're so terrified of pine martins that they literally spend their summers looking over their shoulders, and they don't put on enough weight to get through the winter.
Now, is that the result in Ireland, as you just said? Is that the result of deliberate planning, or is that just the result of an accident?
It was accidental. People sort of suddenly noticed, oh, funny that, the grey squirrels are disappearing and the red squirrels are coming back. And then it was connected to the resurgence of the pine marten. Now, it's true to say, you know, not everything has got a predator. If you have an introduced species, it can thrive sometimes because there is no natural predator. But what we sometimes find is that native predators then suddenly wake up to the fact that there's this new species around and could be quite tasty. And so, bizarrely, in London, people have been noticing tawny owls now eating those ringnet parakeets. They catch them in the trees at night. And that was completely unexpected. Tawny owls normally eat mice. And so. You know, if you allow your predators to come back, you can at least keep some of these invasive species under control.
Do you think that we should go further than that? And, I mean, parakeets are a particular annoyance to me. Anybody that's been to Kew Gardens will have heard the... Even the planes get drowned out by those luminous, squawking things. Grey squirrels, parakeets, the muntjac, I mean, there's others, the American bullfrog, the American mink, apparently is an issue. Do you think that we should get involved in eradicating these while at the same time reintroducing animals that used to roam here?
Yes, in some cases I think we should. So the particular problem with the parakeets is that they occupy all the nesting holes and push out our native birds, and then our native birds have got nowhere to nest. And they can be very aggressive and you know, do a similar thing to what the grey squirrel has done to the red squirrel. Grey squirrels are sort of much bigger and more dominant, and they push the red squirrels out. They also spread squirrel pox to them, which grey squirrels can survive and the red squirrels can't. So, you know, there's a strong case that if you want to have a global diversity of wildlife, you have to control these invasive exotic species. Otherwise, everywhere becomes the same. You know, you'll have particular species which dominate all over the world. And, you know, things like the introduction of the grey squirrel and the muntjac, both of whom I believe were introduced by the Duke of Bedford. He had great contribution, mate. Thanks for that. just feeding generations, thank you for it. They're a real problem. You know, and it's very hard to establish new woodlands today because the grey squirrels rip the young trees to pieces.
But there seems to be a lack of political will to actually address this. Is it because people think, oh, they're cute?
It is partly that, and you do get a lot of resistance to trying to get these issues under control. And you know, my feeling is, you know, I love animals. I've devoted my whole life to wildlife and to the ecosystems, but that we do have to be quite hard-headed when it comes to some of this decision-making. And, you know, we have so many grey squirrels and so many deer, by the way, because we don't have the wolves and lynxes which would otherwise be eating those deer, that you just can't. In many parts of the country now, you cannot establish new woodland, and the old woodlands are dying because they eat all the young trees,
and there aren't any trees to replace the old ones when they die off. And so lovely ancient woodlands shrink and shrink and disappear, and then many other species lose their habitats. So if we don't want this sort of ecological desertification to happen, and we do want to keep this huge range of beautiful species that we have, then we have to make some quite hard-headed decisions. And the decisions which would lead to getting rid of the grey squirrel, and my own belief is that the pine marten is the best way of doing that, and greatly controlling the numbers of deer, and ideally bringing back lynx, which is something that some people are working towards at the moment, all those would be very ecologically beneficial.
George, very good to talk to you. George Monbiot, Guardian columnist and environmental campaigner. So what do you think about that? I mean, should we take action to rid our country of the animals that don't belong here, like grey squirrels and muntjacs and parakeets, especially parakeets? Do we have the stomach for mass culling of the things that look so cute? And with the reintroduction of golden eagles, apparently it's part of a £60 million fund for species recovery. And that was announced by DEFRA last week. So given that there's 60 million quid on offer, are there any other animals that we should encourage back? And do you take things into your own hands by feeding wild animals where you live? 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. What would you like from your investing app? 6% interest on your ISA, a free share of your choice, or no commission on stocks and ETFs up to €100,000 per month? With XTB, you get all of the above all in one app, the XTB app. Get your free share and start investing with XTB today. XTB, where your money works.
Capital at risk. Investment values can rise or fall. Limited free stock availability. 2% ISA rate boost for 90 days. New clients only. T's and C's apply.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep on going under.
Get that Toyota electric feeling with the all-new, all-electric Toyota Urban Cruiser. Available with 0% APR representative and £1,500 deposit contribution. And save £1,500 with the Toyota Electrified Saving. Visit your nearest Toyota centre.
Price from $299,995. Available on Toyota PCP when financed through Toyota Financial Services by 30th of June 2026. Optional final payment. Indemnities may be required. See website. Conditions apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
On this subject about reintroducing animals and perhaps culling those, the ones that have proliferated here and they don't belong here, they don't belong here, Anna says, what about people walking dogs? Especially small ones. It could be a concern if not mitigated. Presumably, what Anna is saying is that small dogs might be at risk of being hoiked off by an eagle. I suppose that would be, a small dog would be the snack they could eat between meals without ruining their appetite. Belfast. Hello, Alan.
Hello there, Alan. Nick. Yeah, two young eagles, they were, they've been bred, they were from Scotland, poisoned.
What, near Belfast?
Ballymena, Slemish.
You're going to have to turn your radio down, Alan, because...
Alexa, off.
Yeah, there's a delay and it's going to confuse you.
I forgot that was on.
Right.
Yeah.
So you
they were said they were from Scotland. Yeah,
right.
But they're bred... They're coming over here. They're coming over here taking our... Uh-huh. But they're dead now. Two young eagles.
And how did they die?
Poisoned.
Oh, they were poisoned. Right.
Yeah.
So you think farmers maybe poisoned them?
I would say, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was in the country, Slemish.
And how do they know that they came from Scotland?
No, well, that was what they said on the radio. Them eagles were from Scotland.
Right.
So if they're roosting over here...
That's one of the reasons that they died out in the first place, wasn't it? That farmers saw them as competition. Well, essentially, they were eating into their profits in even a small way. But I guess if the government is prepared to repay farmers for whatever damage the eagles make, then I wonder if that would persuade farmers not to kill them, or whether they'd continue to go ahead and kill them anyway.
I love your program, Mike.
All right. Thanks a lot, Alan. 0345 6060 973. One thing about birds that I did read lately is that we're not supposed to feed them anymore because there's some sort of disease going round. Have you managed to figure a way out around that into still feed the birds but without passing on the disease? Is there a way to do that to help birds through a period of low food, lack of water and so on? But if you put a feeder out and it starts passing on disease, then that is something to be avoided. And apparently the advice is to not do that. What do you think about the idea of getting rid of grey squirrels? I mean, they're not a threat to us personally, but they've certainly managed to remove red squirrels from most of our lived lives, really. I can't remember the last time I saw a red squirrel, and it's one of the apart from on the cover of a Christmas card, they're one of the symbols of the country, and yet we have allowed them to be completely wiped out by these grey squirrels, which don't really belong here. But would you agree that we should get rid of them by mass killing? Do you think that we actually have the stomach for that kind of thing? And if we can do that, then perhaps there's other animals that we should do the same with. And muntjacs is perhaps one of them, because they're everywhere and they're quite destructive. And they're big too. I was really quite surprised that there are so many of them around where I live, just south of London. And they seem to, like foxes, they seem to be taking over. And, come to think of it, what about foxes? They are taking over. Glasgow. Hello, Eric.
Hey, Nick. Hey, hiya. Yeah, I understand what you're saying about the poor, the game. Would you class squirrels as game?
Would I class what as game?
Would you class squirrels as game? You know, you get pheasant as game, you get salmon as game, deer as game. Would you class squirrel as a game?
Well, we don't eat them. I think that's the definition, isn't it?
Well, it won't be long until I think we're going for them soon. But the rest of the world is going, I think, to be honest. I've got two crossbows in the house, right? I'm from Scotland. And I'm preparing myself. I'm able enough. I'm an ex-soldier. I can go hunting go fishing. And the fish I eat.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But you have a crossbow.
Two crossbows, yeah.
Right, and what can you hunt with that?
Well, it depends. There's legislation coming in now that you're not supposed to have them. I think that's coming into practice soon. You're going to have licenses for them.
Mm.
I've not used them for specific game, as in squirrels and rabbits and so on and so forth. But I'm thinking to myself, the way the world's going, and the cost of stuff.
Yes.
It won't be long until you're shooting these things to eat.
Well, it's good to be at least able to be self-sufficient.
Yeah. Just a thought, Nick. Just a thought for the future.
Yeah. Okay. Well, leave your address at the door, and in the worst circumstance, I might join you for dinner. Thanks, Eric. 0345 6060 973. Phil says, anyone who finds gulls annoying, beware. You'll run for your life from eagles. Yeah, I can't imagine the eagles would be very interested in nicking your chips, though. It does surprise me that gulls are a protected species. I think that we should be protected from them, not the other way around. Atlanta, Graham.
I want all squirrels to be no more, like the parrot. A squirrel no more.
Now, what kind of squirrels do you have there? They're red ones or gray?
I have these damn gray squirrels, and every time I put sunflowers in the ground, they eat them. So I'm forced to put them in 4-inch pots and then plant the seedlings.
I didn't know that squirrels ate flowers.
They will Oh, my. No, they don't. They eat the seeds. You two were talking about
the seeds.
About the birds.
Right.
Eating sunflower seeds. The squirrels are relentless. I got to do it in pots first. You know, the interesting thing about red squirrels I read the other day, they have leprosy.
Leprosy?
A type of leprosy, yeah. I don't know when I read that, but I was thinking of you when I read it.
Well,
you have leprosy, but you brought up red squirrels frequently.
I got it. Right. Okay. Well, thanks for the thought. Is the grey squirrel natural to America, or is it an unnatural interloper like it is in this country?
Well, it's probably, they probably like rats that came over to you guys, you know?
Oh,
on a ship.
It's our fault?
Because they are actually rats with bushy tails.
Yes, well,
that's what they are.
That's what they kind of appear to be, yeah.
And pigeons are flying rats.
Hmm, as Woody Allen famously said.
Oh, is that right? Oh.
Yeah. You can shoot them in America. Well, I guess you can shoot anything in America, can't you?
No, you can't, Nick. Come on.
No?
Get off of that. No. You have to have a permit to plunk a squirrel. You know, Bambi, different. I shoot Bambi when I can. They're tasty.
Well,
boy, are they tasty.
Well, that's
Black
true,
protein,
yeah.
No fat.
We do remove... the notion of where our dinner comes from by calling it something else.
You know what I can't. You know what I can't get. Speaking of dinner is or breakfast, I can't get kippers here.
Why would you want them?
They're delicious with fried tomatoes and an egg. Yummy.
Oh.
And also, what else can I get? Good lamb. No good lamb here. If anybody's listening who's a butcher, I'll take some lamb.
Too fatty, Graham.
Well, once in a while. I mean, I was raised on it. Mom and Dad cooked the lamb. Mint jelly. Mmm, delicious. the only red meat I would eat really is lamb.
Right. Okay, good talking to you, Graham. Thanks for that. Charles says, I feed my birds, so I just spread it around the garden, and grey squirrels are great barbecue food. Oh, I've not tried, but I have eaten guinea pigs when I was in Ecuador, and it tastes just like chicken. I had an idea you were going to say that. If you spread food around the garden, then grey squirrels may be tree rats, but you're going to get actual rats. I'm not sure that's a great idea. Liz says, you've got to get rid of bait boxes with poisons. Eagles would die from eating a mouse who ingested that poison. Yep, no doubt about that. All right, thanks for that. I'm going to take a break for the news, after which we are off to space. And before the hour is out, we're going to check in with our US correspondent. It's 12:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
After being announced by President Trump on Sunday, a US blockade of the Strait of Hormuz is due to begin at 3 o'clock this afternoon UK time. Downing Street says Sir Keir Starmer stressed the need to protect the freedom of navigation in the shipping lane during a phone call on Sunday with President Macron of France. The Liberal Democrats are saying they will make a call in Parliament later for a cut in fuel duty after large price rises caused by the war in Iran. The party says it will table a motion demanding an immediate reduction of 10 pence on every litre. And Rory McIlroy's become only the fourth golfer to retain the Masters title after winning by one shot. The defending champion came in just ahead of world number one Scottie Scheffler at Augusta. LBC weather, sporadic and isolated showers for much of the UK overnight, but they will be more concentrated over northern and northwestern Scotland. Chilly under clear skies in places with a low of around 2 degrees.
LBC.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and run.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest, fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
Next.
Hi, just these, thanks. Did you do cashback?
Just need to check you're not a robot first. New security policy.
Okay.
How many traffic lights can you see out the window?
Oh, two.
No, that's wrong.
Right, well, obviously I'm not a robot.
That's what a robot would say.
What a load of malarkey. Smarty keeps things simple, like 80 gigabytes for £10. And on a rolling monthly SIM plan, you're free to leave any time. Less malarkey, more Smarty. Search Smarty Mobile.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
The four astronauts of Artemis II, the first crewed mission to the moon since Apollo 17 in 1972, splashed down safely off the coast of San Diego this weekend. Let's talk about that and what is to come next with Dr. Jenny Millard. Dr. Millard is an extragalactic astronomer and co-presenter of the Awesome Astronomy podcast, and she joins us on the line now. Good evening, Doctor.
Hello. Hi, hello.
Very good of you to join us. Why has all this taken so long? 1972, long time ago.
It is a long time ago. There's a few reasons. So, first of all, there's politics. So, after we'd landed on the moon with Apollo 11, and then, well, Apollo 13 got a little bit of attention because of the near catastrophe that it was. But after that, public interest waned in the Apollo missions. And so if the public aren't interested, since it's taxpayers' money that funds it, then the program sort of dwindles and came to an end. We had actually planned Apollo 18 and 19, but they got cut. And so then the focus shifted for NASA. They focused on long duration exploration with humans. So this is where space stations come in, like Skylab. And then, of course, the International Space Station that we know and love today. And they also focused on space telescopes, you know, the most famous, I think, of all being Hubble. But then after they'd done this for a number of years, what they want to do now is combine that long distance exploration that we had with Apollo with long duration that we've had with space stations. And so this is Project Artemis. It's about going back to the moon and staying. And those last two words are absolutely critical because it's not the short hops to the moon. It'll begin like that as we rebuild technology and skills, but it is all about then establishing a permanent human presence there.
And for a permanent human presence, we're going to need water, aren't they? Is the presumption that they will find water on the moon?
Yeah, so we know that there's water on the moon, and there's billions of tons of it, and it's locked up in the form of water ice, and mostly at the bottom of permanently shadowed regions. So these are the bottoms of craters near the South Pole, and likely the North Pole. It's just the South Pole that's been the main focus of research. And these are craters where sunlight never penetrates the bottom. So because the moon spins almost vertically upright, it means that at the South Pole, the sun kind of just skims the horizon. And so there are regions where it's very cold, the sunlight can't get there. And so then water ices can't then heat and evaporate away. And this ice is not, it's not like we're going to look at the bottom of these craters and there's just huge blocks of ice that we can just mine and get on with. It's all mixed up in the rock and the regolith. And so we have to develop ways to extract that water from the rock, from the regolith. But then once we've got that water, it's not just for consuming, so not just for drinking and using for making food and such like, but we can split it into hydrogen and oxygen, and that oxygen can be used to breathe. But then also we can use it to burn that hydrogen fuel that we can make. So mining water on the moon is really important.
It sounds a bit chicken and egg, though, because if we had to go through a process of getting the water out of the rock, then we would have to be there to do that, surely.
Yeah.
And if we're there, then we're going to need the water before we mine it. Is that right?
Yeah, so there is a little bit of that aspect, which is why when we first go to the moon, the missions will be shorter, because we can't take everything that we need with us to be there for months and months on end. That's why the first missions will be several days, then it'll ramp up to several weeks, and then as we develop that technology and it matures, then we can start extending out the length of the missions. Also, we can start establishing more permanent resources up there in terms of water recycling and things like that, so that it's not every time we have to sort of take everything with us. But again, it takes time to build those technologies.
And presumably the water will have come from comets and things like that that smashed into the moon at some point. So they will have come from some other part of this or another galaxy. So might it have contaminants that we might not even recognise?
It could possibly, but we think that the water on Earth likely came from asteroids or comets, and some would have been there when it formed as well, but mostly from comets and asteroids impacting at a later date. And so the composition of the water on the moon is likely to be very, very similar to that on Earth. It may have some contaminants, but if we can extract it, we can certainly clean it up and make it into the form that we need.
But they didn't find water when they went to the moon before. Is that because they were in areas where the sun had reached and it would have evaporated?
The Apollo missions are more around the equator, so they do stray a little bit north and south of the equator, but it's mainly around the sort of the middle band of the moon. If you sort of split it into thirds, they're sort of like in that middle third is where all the Apollo missions, they didn't venture near the South Pole.
Right.
And it's very tricky terrain there. It's very heavily craters. You've got issues with power because the sun is so low on the horizon all the time. It's quite cold there as well because there's lots of shadows because of the low sun. So if you've got any kind of mountains, crater rims, creates lots of cold regions. So it is going to be a difficult place to explore, but that's where the water is, and we so desperately need it for that long duration exploration of the moon.
And they're absolutely certain that there is there. They're not just sort of crossing their fingers and thinking, well, let's hope so.
No, absolutely. So it was first discovered, I believe it was 2008 is when we got the first hints of water there. It's been detected directly, and then through where we've had impactors that we've purposefully dropped onto the moon, it's kicked up material and it's been detected there. And then also by proxy through the presence of hydrogen and hydrogen molecules. And different missions have done it. So there's been missions involving India and America. So lots of different countries have concluded that there is water there, but it's locked up in the ice.
Okay. Well, the next mission, Artemis 3, is already being planned. It was going to be the one to set a human back on the moon. And the last time I mentioned it was, that was Apollo 17, wasn't it, in 1972. We haven't been there since. But is that still the plan?
It's not. So they've added another mission in before the landing now. So that extra mission is now called Artemis 3. And this one is going to be a low Earth orbit mission where the Orion capsule will practice docking with one or possibly two landers, because we have a competition going on at the minute between SpaceX and Blue Origin. So it's Elon Musk versus Jeff Bezos. And we don't know who's going to win in terms of making a lunar lander. Originally, it was going to be SpaceX and a modified version of Starship, but that is really far behind in terms of development. And so a couple of years ago, contracts were reopened and NASA was saying, hey, anyone else want to give this a shot? We'll give you money to get it going. And Blue Origin stepped up to the plate. So later this year, we anticipate that they're going to send an uncrewed version of their lunar lander to the moon. And then hopefully that'll go well. And then I think their general idea is to adapt that then into a human one. Because Blue Origin were always going to send crew to the moon. It was just going to be in much later Artemis missions, but they may well have to accelerate their development if they win.
Getting a vehicle to drive around on the moon used to be what NASA did in-house. Why would they get the guy who owns Amazon to deliver one for them?
So it allows them to spread the cost a little bit and use their money more wisely. So the idea with getting commercial entities involved is that they have a contract with them and they get given a certain amount of money, say $1 billion, $4 billion, whatever it is for that particular purpose. And then if the private entities use up that money, it's up to them to then make up the shortfall. So it's not NASA kind of saying, okay, this is going to cost so much, but then suddenly they've got to magic up extra money. They have a contract, and once that NASA money's gone, they have to make up the shortfall.
Right.
And so it means that NASA's budget gets kind of secured and fixed.
Right.
And it also allows them to do research into other areas so they can keep doing all of the deep space missions in terms of visiting asteroids or planetary work, building space telescopes and such like.
And presumably the benefit of flying to Mars from the moon is that they wouldn't have to escape Earth's gravity.
Yeah, so still got gravity on the moon. It's just a lot less, about a sixth of what we have on Earth. And so then launching, you don't need as much fuel because nothing weighs as much as it does on the surface of the Earth. So that is one advantage of going from the moon. And also, we need to use the moon as almost like a staging post for getting out to Mars, because I know Elon Musk really wants to go. I mean, he wants to go tomorrow to Mars, but we don't have the skills and technology. We just don't. And that is just the fact of it. I mean, we could probably do a one-way mission to Mars, but that would be it. And so we have to use the moon to practice. It's even the things like dealing with a dusty surface, because the dust on the moon, it sticks to everything. It's really abrasive and corrosive. And so is Martian dust. We have to handle being in deep space and exposed to radiation, because Mars doesn't have a global magnetic field like we do, which protects us from a lot of deep space radiation. And the moon doesn't have that protection either. It sits outside of Earth's magnetic field. So it's the perfect proving ground for that. How do we keep people safe? How do we stop them being exposed to too much radiation? And so there's all sorts of things that we can do on the moon to prepare us for Mars. It's almost like a mini Mars simulator, but a lot closer. And so therefore, if anything goes wrong, we can get out there a lot quicker to try and save things.
Do you think that part of the interest in the private sector in all of this is the potential for mining whatever is on the moon? Is there anything on the moon worth mining?
We're unsure on that. There's probably precious metals dotted around on the moon. But I think initially it's just going to be cost ineffective to try and mine them. Eventually it may be a worthy avenue resource, but really it's more about the technology spin-offs that they can develop, because as they develop technology that's needed for these lunar missions, they can patent it and they can adapt it then for use on Earth. And so that's probably where they're going to make their money. There is an element of sometimes it's just blue sky and it's not really commercialized. And so this is where the commercial entities have to try and find that balance. And they'll probably start going into things like tourism as well. And quite often these companies that are doing space is not their single avenue. So we know, you know, that they have different things. Like Elon Musk has got his Tesla cars, for example, and then he's got Starship. And just launching rockets, you know, they can have payloads on there. And so they can kind of draw revenue from other places as well.
Right. If we had a base on the moon and a rocket that could get us to Mars, how long would it take to get there?
Oh, great question. So it entirely depends on the rocket power that you're using, the time of year that you launch as well. When we're launching from Earth, it's an average of about 7 months. Sometimes it's a little bit longer. But really, yeah, it depends on the rockets that are going to be used. So it's hard to say, because we haven't got any rockets that are planned to launch sort of from the moon. I imagine that they may be able to go a little bit quicker. Maybe they can get up to speed quicker. But yeah, hard to say, because ideally you want to cut that journey time down, but it requires technology that doesn't exist yet. So yeah, hard to say.
But 7 months is less than I thought. So it's not like an alien style, deep sleep that they'll have to put the astronauts into. They could just while away the time playing, I don't know, solitaire or cribbage, yeah, or poker or.
Yeah. It's like 7 months, sometimes 9 months, depending exactly when you launch. I mean, if you launch when Earth is on the other side of the sun to Mars, then it takes an awful lot longer, but we tend to avoid those kind of alignments.
Right.
That's why we only launch to Mars every couple of years, because we wait for the Earth-Mars system to be aligned properly so that we can do that 7 month journey, that 9 month journey. Instead of it taking a lot longer. Sometimes the longer path has its advantages. You can do some science along the way. Perhaps you've got another target that you want to visit, such as an asteroid or something like that, or perhaps you want to do it more cheaply. And so then taking the longer road is always cheaper. You can put less propulsion onto your system. So then that can be a cheaper way to do it. But yeah, your quickest one is 7 months, 9 months, around about there.
Very good to talk to you, Doctor. Thanks so much for your time. That's Dr. Jenny Millard, extragalactic astronomer and co-presenter of the Awesome Astronomy Podcast. Now we're going to take a short break, and then it is off to America to talk to our Washington correspondent. This is LBC.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, James Hansen.
At 3, we'll talk about the government's changes to school dinners. At 2, do we need to spend less on welfare? But first, has Donald Trump destroyed America's status as the world's greatest superpower?
James Hansen at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no. Just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
All right, team. Operation Family Getaway is a go. Objectives are beach days, mountain trail, and zero stress. P&O ferries? Booked. Best family summer adventure locked and loaded. Driver, next stop Dover. P&O ferries and relax. The holiday's officially begun.
Plan your getaway the enjoyable way with P&O ferries from Dover to Calais. Book now at poferries.com. Travel without the travel.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost. Because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas, and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
You're in. This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
David Smith is the Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, David.
Hi, great to be here.
Thanks so much for your time. The initial, well, let's hope that just the initial round of peace talks did not result in agreement. And then, which was not unexpected, but what was unexpected is what Donald Trump did next. What was that?
Yes, that's right. 21 hours of talks involving Vice President J.D. Vance failing to achieve a breakthrough. And by the way, at one point, Donald Trump said he doesn't care what the outcome is. But he apparently did catch a degree because his latest announcement now is that the U.S. is going to impose a naval blockade on Iran and the Strait of Hormuz. You know, given we've spent a few weeks trying to get it open, is an interesting reversal. And some commentators said, you know, well, this is like sort of 5D chess. the logic appears to be, you know, and apparently Trump has been discussing this for several days, to take away this leverage that Iran has been enjoying as a bargaining chip by blocking the Strait of Hormuz. One media outlet quoted a U.S. official saying, you know, quote, "We want to take this card from the Iranians," close quote. And so we got a Truth Social post saying that from Trump saying effective immediately, the U.S. Navy, the finest in the world, will begin the process of blockading any or all ships. They'll seek and interdict vessels that have paid a toll to Iran. And anyone who opens fire on the U.S. Will, in his words, be blown to hell. It remains to be seen how this one works out.
If he is playing 5D chess, I think what he's doing is eating the pieces. None of this makes any sense. How is it going to help anybody to have two countries blocking the Strait of Hormuz?
That's a very good question. It's not going to help certainly energy markets and the global economy, one assumes. The Trump logic seems to be that this was a point of leverage for Iran, so perhaps this will take it away from them in some shape or form. But who knows what it means, for example, Chinese, Indian and Pakistani ships that have been operating through the strait so far. They'll be unimpressed by the idea of the US blocking them suddenly. I think there's a, you know, judging by a lot of the reaction from politicians and analysts, it feels like Donald Trump is flailing here, that the whole thing is a mess. They've just never figured out this Strait of Hormuz problem. And this does smack of desperation.
Yes, it sounds a bit like taking somebody's weapon away who is threatening to shoot you and then shooting yourself in order to stop them from doing it. I just can't fathom it. But while all that was going on, while the negotiations were going on, Donald Trump was attending to national business by going to one of those showbiz cage fights in Miami, wasn't he?
That's right. And again, I think some of the reaction to this is the US is no longer a serious country, or certainly its government is no longer serious, because on the one hand, there you have these incredibly tense talks with the whole future of the Middle East, you know, hanging in the balance, and with all the consequences for the global economy. And meanwhile, at the same time, Donald Trump is in Florida watching Ultimate Fighting Championship matches, you know, that particularly brutal sport where, you know, I think people are punching and kicking. And as the New York Times put it, Mr. Trump sat and impassively watched blood and saliva sprayed out from fighters beating each other silly in front of him. So that was bizarre. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, who would normally be taking part in diplomatic conversations, he was also there, perhaps having one or two drinks, and a bunch of the Trump allies and podcasters as well. And then to top it all, there's a video clip going viral of Trump speaking to one of these fighters, telling him how beautiful he is. So, yeah, it's all very surreal.
Yes. His favorite song is YMCA. He admires the beauty of men. He can't stop going on about Arnold Palmer's personal area. He sizes men's shoe size up. I mean, it all points in one direction.
Not only that, but there's many a speech where Trump talks about the handsome pilots he's flying with,
yes,
and you know how they all look from Central Casting. Tom Cruise.
Right.
Yeah.
He did address the surging oil prices by saying that it might get worse, didn't he?
Yeah, that will go down very badly with his voters, of course. The war in Iran triggered the, you know, worst jump in inflation since the pandemic, and there could be no end in sight with what's happening with now this latest standoff and the US joining this closure. And I think Trump is at great risk of appearing cavalier, failing to take people's concerns seriously. You know, this is more than the geopolitics. This is the thing that affects many of his voters. And, you know, he campaigned in 2024 promising to lower prices, and many of them now are hurting because of this.
Yes. And those people at the UFC fight, they're his people, aren't they? They are MAGA types. And I believe that the reception that he got this year was different from the one when he attended a similar event last year.
Yeah, it was, I think, a little more mixed this time. You know, normally it's a, you know, and it's like a Trump rally. As you say, it's the hardcore of Donald Trump's supporters cheering him to the rafters. This time there seemed to be perhaps a little more dissent and ambiguity around that. Notably, Joe Rogan, the podcaster, was there. He's criticized this war, but Trump still greeted him relatively warmly. But yeah, I mean, basically, if Trump loses the UFC crowd, then he's really lost everything.
And just when people had stopped talking about Jeffrey Epstein, along came Melania. What was that about?
Yeah, that was a bolt from the blue. During the week, Melania Trump delivered a speech at the White House, and no one knew what she was going to talk about. And it turned out the focus was Jeffrey Epstein, a convicted paedophile, and Melania was taking great pains to say that she was not a victim of Epstein, hardly knew him, that there are lots of rumours out there about her that were false, denied that Epstein had introduced her to Donald Trump in the first place, and I think a lot of people watching it were scratching their heads, you know, what prompted this? Because it's not as if there had been huge rumours doing the rounds in Washington about Melania Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. You know, maybe one or two emails had come out in the files some months ago, but it was very much on the back burner. And now here she was taking an issue Donald Trump really does not want to talk about and putting it front and centre again, and reports suggested Trump himself didn't really know she was going to do this. There was another theory that, you know, the Iran war is going so badly, maybe they decided better talk about Epstein. Things have got that bad. Yeah, there's still one or two sort of rumors swirling. Perhaps something in Spanish media is going to come out, some accusation against Melania. Perhaps she was trying to preempt that, get ahead of it, but, ultimately, it's still the biggest mystery in Washington this week.
Yes. Well, maybe it will become clear in due course, and maybe not. But what is clear is Trump's vaunting ambition to change the landscape. And he has plans for what one chap called an arc de Trump.
That's right. I was actually the White House pool reporter last Sunday, and we took a detour in the presidential motorcade towards Arlington Cemetery in Northern Virginia, just across the bridge from the Lincoln Memorial, and very slowly did a lap of this roundabout, which is just plain grass at the moment. But that is the proposed site of what's been dubbed the Arc de Trump, an absolutely massive monument, somewhat in the style of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. But with some typically, you know, Trumpian touches and flourishes of gold and so on. And, that's, kind of to get started to celebrate America's 250th birthday, but, yet another, sign of Trump desperately trying to, stamp himself on the Washington landscape along with all those buildings he's put his name on. And and again, just like, you know, the White House ballroom, it's proving controversial. There's a veterans group who are suing, trying to get it stopped because it would block the view of Arlington Cemetery, which is the most sacred place for America's war dead, and obscure the views of the Lincoln Memorial from some angles, because it would be absolutely massive. It would be bigger than the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. It's going to be another test of can Trump just slash through all these regulations and do it, or can lawyers and commissions and so on slow him down?
My money's on the former. Very good to talk to you, David. Thanks so much for that. David Smith, the Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief. Now, if you missed any of this show, then you should be aware that you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the LBC app, where you can also stay up to date with all the latest news, videos and opinions. They're both free, and you can get them from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4, early breakfast with Ian Payne. But first, here's James Hansen.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning. Coming up, more than 20 years since Jamie Oliver waged war on the humble turkey Twizzler. The government is announcing plans to overhaul school meals, including banning fish and chips, chicken nuggets and jam donuts. At 3... what should be on school menus? Plus, taxpayers are now shelling out £800 a minute on people who claim disability benefits for anxiety. At 2, can we really afford to spend as much as we do on welfare? But first up this morning, with his war in Iran going disastrously wrong and with Russia and China being the main beneficiaries, here's my question to you this hour. Has Donald Trump destroyed America's status as the world's greatest superpower? 0345 6060 973 is the number. Call me now.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock.
After being announced by President Trump on Sunday, a US blockade of the Strait of Hormuz is due to begin at 3 o'clock this afternoon, UK time. Downing Street says Sir Keir Starmer stressed the need to protect the freedom of navigation in the shipping lane during a phone call on Sunday with President Macron of France. The Middle East correspondent for The Economist, Greg Carlstrom, has been telling LBC Washington has its resources in place.
The Americans do have an aircraft carrier group that is in the Gulf of Oman, so not too far away from the mouth of the strait. They have other vessels in the area. Two American destroyers transited through the straits, and they've been talking about an operation to remove the mines that the Iranians have supposedly laid there.
The Liberal Democrats say they'll make a call in Parliament later for a cut in fuel duty after large price rises caused by the war in Iran. The party says it will table a motion demanding an immediate reduction of 10 pence on every litre. More now from LBC's Holly Harris.
Tonight, the Lib Dems are claiming the Chancellor is expected to receive almost £500 million in extra tax revenue because of the rise in global oil prices. They say the money's being gathered through the government's energy profits levy, and it should now be used to help consumers. The party's Treasury spokesperson, Daisy Cooper, says it's deeply unfair the Treasury's benefiting while drivers are feeling the pinch at a time when many people are struggling with their finances already.